Okay, on the record. Good morning, everyone. Got a pretty full house today. My name's Pat Ward. I'm the administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as procedural hearing officer for this hearing. This hearing is on the application of MDU to increase its 2016 electric service rates. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission consolidated case number PU-16-666. On November 30th, 2016, the commission approved MDU's interim electric rates that increased annual revenue collections by $11,695,592, or an overall increase in electric retail revenues of 5.8% to become effective for electric service on or after December 13, 2016. MDU is required to refund interim revenue amounts in excess of final approved revenue amounts with interest. The issues to be considered in the proceeding, there were six issues that were identified. Normally I would read through those, but my understanding is there's a settlement and there's going to be a prove up of that settlement today. So I'm going to let the parties address those as we get to that. The record will show it's a little past 8:30 a.m., April 10th, 2017. We're at the commission hearing room, 12th floor, State Capitol, 600 East Boulevard Avenue, Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the notice of hearing. Mr. Sanderson, would you state your appearance for the record and the appearance of any individuals from Montana Dakota Utilities at your table?
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Paul Sanderson. I'm an attorney with Evenson Sanderson here in Bismarck, and I'm outside counsel for MDU in this case. At council table with me is Carl Liepitz, Assistant General Counsel with MDU, and also at the table is Tammy Aberle, Director of Regulatory Affairs for Montana Dakota.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General. On behalf of advocacy staff with me is John Shu, Special Assistant Attorney General as well.
Thank you. Jeff Gotsako.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, counsel with the Public Service Commission as advisory staff, and with me is Jerry Lean with the Public Utilities Division.
And Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, appearing on behalf of AARP, I'm John B. Kaufman, and also appearing here on behalf of local counsel Dave Chider.
All right, before we get into marking or talking about the exhibits, I guess I'll ask for opening remarks from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's nice that we could all be gathered here at 8:30 on Monday morning to talk about a settlement. I'm pleased to see that. I've gone through the settlement agreement, obviously. I think you guys worked hard and addressed a lot of the key issues that were out there and needing to be addressed. And so I really look forward to, discussion this morning about the terms of the settlement and getting a little bit more background information on from all the parties on how we got to where we are with this and just a few technical questions about the settlement. But I think that I'm pretty pleased with what the progress is that you guys made and that all the parties, including the AARP, ultimately came on board. So good work in that and look forward to a good discussion this morning and perhaps this afternoon as well.
Chairman Chris.
Well, I also will say I was glad to see on Friday that the settlement had been reached and then late Friday afternoon when we got some information on that. I expected many, many pages to pour through over the weekend. It was rather short and actually pretty well explained, and I thought did a very good job. But I was still left with some questions, and I see now this morning the company has more than made up for that lack of detail and paperwork. So I do still have questions, even though that was a pretty good summary, I thought, and so we'll need more information. I just want to point out for people who are watching or listening in the public, it just always seems logical that the consumers out there are watching this, and so if the choice is higher rates or not higher rates, I'm guessing that most would probably choose not higher rates. But the fact of the matter is our job isn't just to keep rates down. It's to make sure that, the rates are fair for investors, to make sure, most importantly to me, that the power is there and is provided in a dependable way at the best possible price. And so we seek not necessarily just to keep costs down, but to make sure that the company is able to provide the service we expect. And on that note, I will point out, although I did research it just a little bit when I seen this proclamation, and I see in some cases it's listed as April 18th, and in some cases today. So I'm going to go with today being Thank Alignment Day. And the fact of the matter is today we see a lot of executive types, but to me the heart of the industry that we're dealing with here is the linemen and the other people that are out there making sure that, in fact, the power is on. And when I think back, and now I'm getting back to the cost thing, to situations like we had around Christmas time, when people are on their second or third or fourth day of no power, you don't get very many calls from them about that the rates are too high. They just want the power back on. And our linemen and other staff out there do a tremendous job weathering those kinds of storms. I know Commissioner Kalk's dad was a lineman. Commissioner Kramer's dad was a lineman. One of my really good friends at home is a lineman, and it's a pretty big deal. So thank a lineman today.
Something tells me the Wichita lineman is still on the line. Commissioner Crosius, welcome. This is my first hearing with you.
Good morning. I would echo the same comments that Julie and Randy made. It's good to see everyone here today, and also that a settlement was reached late Friday afternoon. If I have my timing down, it was a busy day as we were prepping. I too look forward to hearing more details on the settlement itself, and have a few questions that I've jotted down as a result of reading that, and we'll get into that as we move forward. But and the other part I will add, I think everyone knows I'm the new kid in town, so this is, it's day 16, but it's really not, if you're only counting Monday through Friday. It started a lot sooner than that, and I've enjoyed working with the entire staff. It is a great team up here at the PSC. They have done an incredible job of bringing me along as quickly as they can, and I have a lot to learn yet, but I've thoroughly enjoyed working with all of them, so a shout out and a thank you to them as well.
Thank you. Council exhibits. Do we want to discuss exhibits, pre-marked exhibits?
We can, Your Honor. First, MDU, or Montana Dakota in this case, has an exhibit list, and the exhibits are in front of you. Exhibit one, and we'd offer these at this time. Exhibit one is the application. Exhibit two is the settlement agreement that was reached on Friday. Exhibit 3 is the summary of Nicole Cavisto's presentation that will be given today. And Exhibits 5 through 19 are simply the pre-filed testimony and rebuttal testimony that have been filed in this case, but we wanted those available here at the hearing in case there's any questions regarding that. And then finally, Your Honor, we received a request from Commission staff on late Friday for a late filed or for an updated class cost of service study with some specific information they wanted. Due to the timing of the request, we were not able to prepare that. We've spoken to Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco about filing a late filed exhibit, and we would ask that that be marked MDU 20, and we'd file that as soon as it's complete this week. So at this time, Your Honor, Montana Dakota would file exhibits MDU 1 through 19 and then request that MDU 20 be left open for that late filed class cost of service study.
Mr. Armstrong, any objection?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No objection.
Mr. Kaufman?
No objection.
Okay, exhibits 1 through 19 will be received. Exhibit 20 will be reserved for a late filed exhibit. And what about commission exhibits, Mr. Armstrong?
Thank you. I haven't passed all of ours out yet because ours will come later, but we'll have 12 exhibits, and it's the pre-filed testimony of Richard Polich plus the exhibits to his testimony, the pre-filed testimony of Jacob Thomas plus his exhibits, and then the pre-filed testimony of Sarah Cardwell. So we offer PSC 1 through 12.
Any objection, Mr. Sanderson?
No objection, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
Yes. If appropriate, we would like to also offer into record the exhibits of our testimony.
Okay. Do you have any objection to the PSC?
Oh, no. No objection.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat, sorry.
No. Thank you.
All right. Now, Mr. Kaufman.
Apologize. Yes. And I don't have copies for other folks, but they are, you know, pre-filed in the docket. If copies are necessary, we will make them. But we would offer AARP Exhibit 1, which would be the direct testimony of Nancy Brockway, and AARP Exhibit 2, the rebuttal testimony of Nancy Brockway.
All right, counsel, any objection to those two exhibits?
No objection, Your Honor.
Okay.
No objection.
All right.
No objection. Thank you.
Okay. So AARP Exhibits 1 and 2 will be received, and PSC Exhibits 1 through 12 will be received into the record as well. Opening statements, counsel. Mr. Sanderson?
Yes, Your Honor. Just briefly. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Paul Sanderson. This proceeding was initiated by Montana Dakota with its application filed on October 14th, 2016, seeking an increase in its electric rates. The application proposed an increase in electric rates to provide additional annual revenue of just over $13.3 million, which amounted to an increase in its projected annual retail revenues of 6.6%. The application also sought a return of equity of 10%. Now, this was Montana Dakota's first electric rate increase since its 2010 case. And the increase in rates is necessary in large part to the company's increased investments in facilities to serve and provide quality and reliable service to Montana Dakota's electric customers. And much of the increase in investment is the direct result of the activities that have occurred in western North Dakota and the necessity to serve that increased load growth as a result of the Bakken explosion and development. Now, following significant discoveries between the parties, and mainly during the last 3 weeks, numerous settlement discussions were held between Montana Dakota advocacy staff and the intervening party AARP. And as a result of those settlement discussions, the settling parties reached a settlement agreement last week, which was filed with the commission on Friday afternoon. Now, the key terms of the settlement agreement are as follows. The annual net revenue increase for Montana Dakota would be $7.5 million on its electric rates for retail customers. And the agreed-upon revenue increase represents an overall increase in rates of 3.7%. The parties agreed upon a return of equity of 9.65% moving forward, and that the true-up adjustments for the generation, transmission, and renewable riders approved on an interim basis will be calculated at a return of equity of 9.45%. And the increased residential daily basic service charge will be increased to 46 cents per day. Now, Montana Dakota will be calling its president and CEO, Nicole Cavisto, here this morning to provide an overview of the application, present the terms of the settlement agreement, and answer any questions you may have. In addition, the company has available today all of its witnesses and experts who submitted testimony in this case, should you have any additional questions of them that you would like answered. And as you just heard, all of the pre-filed testimony has been received as exhibits into this case, and you have those in front of you today. You also heard on Friday evening the company received a request from Ms. Jeffcoat Sacco to provide the results of the updated class cost of service study, and that will be filed as a late filed exhibit here. So, on behalf of Montana Dakota, I'd like to thank advocacy staff and its counsel and AARP and its counsel for their hard work and effort in reaching this settlement agreement. There were numerous times, I believe, where both sides did not think we would be able to reach a settlement agreement and present it here today due to the contentious nature of the issues. But however, through the diligent and hard work of all the parties, we were able to reach an agreement that benefits both the company and, we believe, the retail customers in North Dakota. Now, in conclusion, the settlement agreement is the product of numerous hours of negotiation between the company and the parties, and reflects a compromise each party deemed beneficial on the critical issues in this case. Moreover, the settlement agreement was a recognition by the parties of the substantial amount of time and cost that would be involved and could be incurred by each party in future litigation and the potential of years' worth of appeals in this case. And for these reasons, Montana Dakota respectfully requests that the Commission adopt the settlement agreement that was submitted by the parties in this case. We look forward to presenting our witness and evidence in this case and answering any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sanderson. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor. Advocacy staff will be calling one witness to discuss the settlement. That will be Victor Shook. We also have, to the extent the Commission has any additional questions, I'd like to introduce the rest of staff that is here today. Sarah Cardwell, Rich Polich, and Jacob Thomas were all part of staff, and you'll see their testimony that was filed as well. I'd like to thank them for their hard work on this case, as well as the company and AARP. Overall, I think what you'll see is that the settlement agreement results in fair, just, and reasonable rates for the company, for the public, and we'll request that it be approved. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, good morning. May it please the Commission. We're very happy to be here, and we're very happy to be part of the proposed settlement in this case. We don't have an expert witness here with us, although if it was the desire of the Commission, our expert witness would be available by phone. I don't know if that's necessary. We are very happy with the settlement. Definitely extend thanks to both the Council for MDU and for the advocacy staff. This settlement is definitely the result of compromise and hard work on behalf of all the parties. I think that on many points it was a stretch for everyone involved, but when we look at it, we think it is a very good result and a just and reasonable proposal to settle the case. The main sticking point for AARP was the fixed charge and our concern about the lowest users and folks on fixed incomes. And so we were struggling with the basic service charge, which was proposed to go from 35 cents to 65 cents. Ultimately, everyone stretched and we reached a compromise of 46 cents. And we can talk about that later if you have questions, but we're here today to support the settlement and are very happy with the result.
Is Jeff Kotsako, any opening remarks?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Just looking out at the room, we do have a full room, so I'll just ask if there's anyone present other than witnesses for MDU, the Commissioner, AARP, who will or may want to testify concerning this matter. And seeing none, I won't go on with the rest of that. Mr. Sanderson, I think you can go ahead and call your first witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Montana Dakota would call Nicole Cavisto.
Ms. Cavisto, I am required by law to advise you of the penalties regarding perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison, a fine of $10,000, or both. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson.
Ms. Cavisto, could you please state your full name and business address?
Yeah, my name is Nicole Cavisto. My business address is 400 North 4th Street.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota Utilities?
I am the president and CEO.
And Ms. Cavisto, have you testified in other proceedings before state regulatory bodies?
I have. We operate in an eight state territory, and I've testified in front of all eight states.
And did you authorize the filing of Montana Dakota's rate application in this case, which has been marked as MDU-1?
I did.
And did you also authorize Montana Dakota to enter into the settlement agreement with advocacy staff and AARP, which has been marked as Exhibit 2 in this proceeding?
I did.
And in addition, have you submitted pre-filed direct testimony in this case, which has been marked as Exhibit 4 in this case?
Yes.
And Ms. Cavisto, have you prepared PowerPoint slides regarding your testimony today?
I have.
And what areas are addressed by your testimony and PowerPoint slides?
I was going to provide an overview of the company in total and then an overview of our initial application as well as the results of the settlement agreement.
If using your PowerPoint slides, please feel free to present your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to maybe start off by introducing our corporation. For those of you that are not familiar, we operate under MDU Resources, which is our parent company. And MDU Resources operates under two pillars primarily, a construction pillar and a regulated energy delivery pillar. As you can see on this slide here, the major companies served under our parent company are listed. Our regulated utility companies operate under four brands, and you can see those listed on the slide here, of which we are talking about Montana Dakota Utilities today. All of our utility operations have separate financials, separate financing, and are operated completely independent of our non-regulated businesses. So as an example, earlier last year, we did announce as a corporation the sale of our oil and gas business as well as the sale of our refinery. The sale of those businesses had no impact on our utility brands or their customers. Just providing a quick overview of our electric service that we provide in the state of North Dakota, we have 100,687 customers, and you can see that the large share of those customers are residential in nature. We serve 117 communities with two regional offices located in Bismarck and Dickinson, and currently have around 567 employees. And as a reminder, we are a fully integrated utility with generation, transmission, and distribution. Now, moving on to just a quick overview of our application. Paul summarized some of this briefly earlier, but as a reminder, we filed our initial application in October of 2016 to increase rates by $13.4 million, which would have represented a 6.6% overall increase at a rate of return of 7.459%. Our last general rate case was filed in 2010 with rates effective in 2011. An interim increase was granted at $11.7 million or 5.8% effective in December of 2016. In the course of the proceeding, we did update our 2016 actuals, which did reduce our overall request from $13.4 to $12.2 million, which represents a 6% overall increase. So why the need for a rate increase? Paul summarized some of this in his opening remarks, but we have an obligation, as Commissioner Christman said here, to provide safe and reliable service. And to do that, we saw a need since our last general rate case for an increased investment in our facilities. Because of that increased investment, of course, we saw higher depreciation expense. We also, since our last case, have seen increased O&M. And then in this application, we also filed for decommissioning expense, and we have seen some higher property taxes since our last general rate case. The investments that I am referring to were investments beyond what was currently being recovered through our riders. We also, of course, through over the last several years, have seen impacts in the Bakken region. You know, our communities that we serve, we serve the communities, not the oil rigs, and so we saw substantial growth in our communities. And this drove, of course, the need for some of this incremental investment, as we discussed. Due to the increase in demand and the higher production that we saw in the Bakken area, of course, the company was challenged with employee turnover. We were seeing employee turnover in our Bakken region at 2 to 3 times our normal turnover rate, also having to add additional employees in the area. We were seeing construction wages in that area increase in 10 to 15% annually. And, of course, we're all well aware of some of the housing situations out there with one-bedroom apartments demanding $2,000 to $3,000 per month. In a lot of our communities, we did see in the Bakken area populations double. Peak demand doubled in the western region. And in addition to just the Bakken, outside of the Bakken area in our communities in North Dakota, we also continue to see customer increases. Of course, as mentioned in the case, Basin Electric's load growth had a substantial impact on Montana Dakota as well, because we are transmission dependent on Basin and WAPA in the western region. Of the total growth that was seen in the Bakken area, Montana Dakota only served 10% of that growth. And so you can see that the REC's demand was substantial as well. So without a capacity addition in the western region, our firm service customers were facing electric interruptions starting in the winter of 2015. And therefore, the Rice project was determined to be the only option. When looking at our investment, this slide certainly provides a visual in terms of the growth that we have seen since 2010 through 2017. We saw an incremental investment of $649 million since our last general rate case in 2010. And you can see on this chart the various categories in which that increase was seen. This also provides a summary of the $649 million broken down by category, with the largest being our production facilities. $362 million of incremental capital was spent in our production facilities for environmental compliance, to provide low-cost energy to displace purchases, and, of course, to meet those growing capacity requirements I just discussed. We also saw $119 million of incremental transmission expenditures for reliability, bulk power, and in addition to that, we did have some storm damage replacement. And you can see also distribution was an incremental $136 million, and then $32 million of incremental dollars related to work equipment, office space, and new technology. Of that $649 million, $280 million, or approximately 44%, was being recovered through our riders. Specifically, as it relates to the production plant investment, with that being the highest incremental investment, I just wanted to provide a quick summary of our generation facilities and where we saw changes. At Heskett 3 and Lewis and Clark, the Rice units that we added both of those for demand and reliability. And at our Lewis and Clark and Big Stone station, you can see those were primarily driven by environmental upgrades needed to meet environmental standards. And then, of course, our Thunder Spirit Wind project to provide incremental energy. With these changes, this slide gives you a summary of our resource type and the capacity that we have. You can see that coal has essentially remained unchanged. With, of course, the addition of Rice and Heskett 3, you can see our natural gas portfolio has increased. And then again, with the Thunder Spirit Wind addition, we saw an increase in our renewable portfolio, currently operating at about 22% of our overall portfolio. All of those then, of course, reduced our need to purchase capacity, and you can see that on this slide going from 110 to 17. Our transmission and distribution plant investment, the increases there were caused largely from increased capacity required to serve our customers, system upgrades due to age, and then storm damage replacements, as well as reliability enhancements. Just a quick summary then of the rate riders in the case and in our original application, what our recommendation was for how to move forward with those. The company has a transmission cost adjustment under Rate 59. Expenses associated with regional transmission organizations, as well as two large transmission projects, were included in that rider, and we propose to continue to move move our transmission investment to base rates, but continue with the transmission expense in that tariff. On the renewable resource cost adjustment, this, of course, accounted for the investment in Thunder Spirit Wind facility. We propose to continue with this rider, but also include our other wind facilities of Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow in the rider on a go-forward basis. Moving on to our generation resource recovery rider, that included our investment in Heskett 3 as well as our Rice generation additions. And we have proposed, we had proposed in the original application to move those to base rates. I'll discuss in a minute our new proposal as an outcome of the settlement. And then finally, in the environmental cost recovery rider under Rate 57, that did include the investments, as I previously mentioned, of AQCS at the Big Stone plant and then the MATS project at Lewis and Clark. We have proposed under the application to move those into base rates. So now moving on to just a quick summary of the settlement that we've reached in the case. Before I do that, I do want to, as has previously been mentioned, certainly thank all the parties, advocacy staff, and AARP. There was a lot of work that went into this case and a lot of work that went into the settlement. I believe we have reached what is a fair settlement, and I'm going to summarize that here in a minute. Our original increase of 13.4 has been reduced to 7.4%. $1.5 million. And you can see here on the slide, as well as what's been provided in the settlement agreement, really a reconciliation of that, getting from that 13.4 to the 7.5 million. At a 7.5 million revenue request, this is an overall increase for our customers of 3.7%, with inclusive of a return on equity of 9.65%. As previously mentioned by Mr. Sanderson, the riders with an interim ROE in a generation transmission renewable riders will be trued up based on a 9.45% ROE. And then here is what has changed as part of the settlement is the Lewis and Clark Rice units. We propose that those remain in the generation rider and continue at a 9.45% ROE through December 31st of 2019. The balance in the generation rider will be rolled into retail rates in the first rate case to be effective after 12/31 of 19. A couple other elements of the settlement to highlight. All wind facilities will be moved into the renewable rider as proposed, and the transmission rider will be adjusted as proposed as well. Compliance tariffs will include modifications supported by staff, as we've outlined in the settlement agreement, and the company will work with staff in regard to the presentation of the fuel cost adjustment and deposit information, and the company will review and report to the commission regarding its current contract rates by 9/30 of 17. In addition, an interim refund plan will be submitted for approval. Lastly, this slide reflects then the overall revenue increase allocated by customer class, and you can see that presented on the slide. Also, as previously mentioned, we will be adjusting the residential base service charge, and that will be set at 46 cents per day. All told, then, your average residential customer using 980 kilowatts will see an average increase of $450 per month. So in summary, we believe the settlement results in just and reasonable rates while providing safe and reliable services to the North Dakota customers that we have the privilege to serve, and would recommend your request and request your approval of that settlement.
Thank you, Ms. Cavisto. I have no further questions, Your Honor. We tender her for cross-examination.
Mr. Armstrong, questions for Ms. Cavisto? None?
No.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions.
Commissioners? Commissioner Fedorchik?
This is the hard part about settlement agreements is all the parties have already asked all their questions, so we have to be ready to go. That's all right. That's good. Okay. Thank you, Nicole. Appreciate your presentation and some of the background and reminders. Just back up a little bit more. Tell me, how did the company arrive at its original request? Because I think the public looks at something like this, $13.4 million request, and the ultimate is 7.5. And either we look like really good heroes or you guys ask for too much. So tell me how you get to your original request.
Yeah, our original request, as you know, takes into consideration, of course, the investment that we have spent and plan to spend in 2017, as well as we are able to do a forecasted test period here. It looks at our expense as well. So, of course, our base investment, getting to a rate base, the expense that goes into that as well to serve, and then a requested return. And as you can see, as part of the settlement, there were moving pieces in all really three of those categories in terms of getting to an agreement. And so our original request reflects what we believe was needed to provide safe and reliable service. Yet in the context of a settlement, there is some give and take by all parties. And as you know, our counsel, Paul Sanderson, already mentioned, there were a lot of contentious discussions getting to where we are today, but we do believe that we have reached a fair settlement.
How does the downturn in the Bakken affect your cost projections and your revenue projections? So this was made earlier in the year. Things really haven't improved out there. How do you see things long term?
Yeah, really, when we look at what was included in this case, maybe I'll start with a couple different factors in the Bakken area. Our customer growth at its peak in the Bakken was, you know, I think we peaked out at a 9% growth rate out there. Our communities served, for example, Williston literally doubled in population. When you look at our customer growth, let's just take 15 over 16, we really saw it flatline. So we're not seeing a mass exodus from the community. So again, as a reminder, we are not serving the rigs and the oil wells. We're serving the communities that serve those. And so we have not seen a significant pullback in our customer count in the Bakken. That being said, when you look at the forecast that was provided as part of this case, we did reflect a change a little bit in the energy in terms of the overall forecasted volumes that we would be producing and selling. And so really that was already reflected in this case. Now, what the future will hold out there is uncertain, but we're certainly not seeing a major drop-off in the customers that we serve out in the Bakken area. From an expense perspective, this case also reflects our current cost to serve the communities out there. We were at the real height of the Bakken. We had situations where we were putting in incremental incentive pay to keep employees in the communities. That is no longer needed and is not a factor here. So we believe that what we had in the case here is representative of our cost to serve on a go-forward basis in the Bakken.
Okay, so you don't see your revenues dropping, but you also don't see your expenses growing out there based on what your forecasts are.
Right. I mean, our cost to serve, I mean, other than your standard inflationary costs, right. I would say we don't expect any major additional employee counts. We have stabilized the employee count. We believe the customers have stabilized as well.
Mm-hmm. And your generation resources, you feel like that's hard to predict, you know, when you're looking at growth and kind of preparing for that and adding resources, and now it's flat. So how do you feel you are today with your resources to serve?
Where we sit today, we are currently working through our IRP that will be submitted here in the summer to the commission here. And over the next five-year period, what we're really looking at is, of course, we've made the announcement on the PPA on Thunder Spirit 2, the 50-megawatt addition there, and we'll be potentially looking at an ADP to purchase that. Outside of that, we don't see any major changes over the, I would say, near-term or five-year period with respect to generation resources.
Okay. So does that mean that you probably won't need to come back here for a rate increase anytime soon?
That is really hard to predict. I mean, if indeed we move forward with an ADP on Thunder Spirit Wind, in that case, that would fall within the rider that we already have in place here in the state of North Dakota. We certainly are doing everything we can to operate our system as efficiently as possible and looking at technology, as we already have in this case deployed, to reduce our overall costs. But it really is hard to predict, just like we couldn't predict what happened with the Bakken. Sometimes, you know, foresight isn't 100% accurate, as we all know. Hindsight certainly is. But at this juncture, you know, outside of, like I said, the potential ADP we would be filing for Thunder Spirit 2, I don't see any major investment beyond the normal investment needed to serve our customers.
So if you were to estimate how long these rates will be effective for the company, what would you say?
That is really hard to predict. I mean, based on what I know today, you know, I would say we would not have the need for another general for at least a couple years.
Okay. So we were 2017, and I saw some reference to December of 2019. I didn't see any time certain where you can't come back and ask for a rate increase, but I might have missed it in the settlement. There was no timeline like that, right?
There was no timeline. You are correct.
So you could come back in a year if you wanted and needed to, but you don't anticipate that for a couple years.
Correct.
Okay.
No, I guess the only thing I would add to that is the way the Lewis and Clark rider works. If we were to come back before the effective date of that, you know, that would not roll into general rates at that time. So let's just say we filed before that rider rolls off 12/31 of 19. Mm-hmm. That would not be rolled into general at that time. That'd be the only.
So what would happen then? It would just stay
there. It would
there
carry on. Yep.
December of, okay.
31st of 19.
All right. You talked about how the company had, I forget, $280 million of the total increase in your investments was covered by the riders. Is there any way to characterize how much of your that investment, or maybe that's the same thing, but was covered by growth? Growth in customers and
right. I do not have that in front of me, and I don't know that we could necessarily characterize that.
Okay. That's another question
Precisely.
We get a lot from
yeah.
folks who say, well, why isn't the growth paying?
Right.
Why aren't the new customers paying for the new investments needed to serve those customers? So what do you say to
that? I think the general response to that is when you're talking about a build-out of, you know, service lines or distribution lines to a customer's home, certainly generally you can see sometimes that growth pays for itself. When you're talking about generation resource additions as well as environmental costs needed to continue to operate our coal fleet, you know, those are of a size that growth is certainly not going to cover those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you mentioned the coal fleet, so I'll ask my next question related to that. And I think it was page 12 of the slides
okay.
where you had the bar graph. I might be wrong. No. Of your generation mix.
Page 11.
Okay, 11. So your coal is pretty strong in that generation mix, and you mentioned that you don't anticipate that changing. Talk to me a little bit about that, and we'll get into more of that in the resource planning, I understand, but talk to me a little bit more about that. The additions we're seeing was the additions needed to serve the new customers, correct?
Correct, yep.
And the coal runs stable. Do you anticipate that coal bar decreasing in the next 10 years?
In the next 10 years, I mean, over the short-term horizon, we do not have any plans, nor have we announced any plans at any of our coal facilities. As part of the IRP, certainly, you know, we are looking at that as you go beyond 5 years. To your comment on 10 years, you know, potentially within that time frame, as we look at incremental costs to keep those facilities running, you know, there may be a situation where we make a decision, but I do not see that in the near-term 5-year forecast.
Okay. Now to some more specific questions for this settlement. There's a lot of back and forth on the decommissioning expenses in the pre-filed testimony and rebuttal testimony. And can you... You're an accountant, right?
I am.
I'm not.
Okay.
So can you explain to me what's going on? What's the company trying to do with its decommissioning expenses, and what happened with them as a result of this settlement? How are they being treated?
Sure.
And how does it apply to each specific resource that you have that will someday have to decommission?
Okay, so maybe just stepping back on the concept of decommissioning, just as you mentioned, at some point when you enter into a retirement of facility, there is generally a cost to retire the facility. So that is essentially what decommissioning is getting at, is what I would call a way to pay for that retirement of that facility at some point in the future. We had originally... entered into our application with a request for, I believe it was $1.9 million of decommissioning expense. And essentially how that would work is the company, it is really a zero-sum game for the customer, or for the shareholder. I want to make that clear. The company does not make any money off of decommissioning. What we are doing is charging the customers for that future liability. So essentially we would have a revenue stream with an offsetting expense that would essentially lower our rate base. And so at the end of the day, if the true cost to decommission that facility is less or more, there would be a true-up. And again, the company is not intending to make money off of this. What ultimately happened in the settlement was an agreement to start the process of decommissioning, but not to account for what we believe is the full cost to decommission. So as part of the settlement, we are starting the decommissioning and have got $500,000 baked into the settlement, which was, again, lower than our original request. But yet we believe in the interest of a settlement that it is a start to the process in terms of collecting dollars as it relates to a future expense.
And which facilities are included in that?
We did not identify it to a specific facility, so it would just be a decommissioning to cover the retirement of facilities in the future, any facility.
So, but this isn't, you're just not now starting to collect decommissioning expenses. What about all the stuff you've already collected from customers for this decommissioning purposes?
We have not had decommissioning as part of our prior rates.
Oh.
We have on our wind facilities, we have decommissioning. On the rest of our fleet, this is the start of the decommissioning process.
Okay.
So in other states we have, but not North Dakota.
Okay. So the decommissioning, the $500,000, tell me how that's going to be handled, the $500,000 that's collected.
Yep. So we would collect it from customers, and so we'd have a revenue stream. We would have an expense to offset that, and then ultimately it reduces the rate base. So in a future case, you know, the customer is going to get charged less because we've already got the collection.
Okay. And what do you do with that money, the $500,000? Is it saved or do you use it, the $500,000 that you collect?
When you say, is it
like a
saved?
Account.
Right.
It's not?
No.
Okay. Okay. So then when you go to, I thought it was interesting how some of the projects had a lower ROE for some of the generation, and I think the environmental rider, or a few of them, few of the different riders you're getting a lower ROE. Can you go to the list of the revenues? So page 15, okay. Can you account for that reduced ROE in a line item up above there? Like, where is the savings reflected in the reduction in the revenues?
Okay, this here reflects the revenue ask. I would say exclusive of the riders. So this reconciliation starts with our original general rate application, and so the refund that will result because of the lower ROE true up on the riders is outside of that reconciliation.
And that'll happen on those riders. That'll be reflected in a lower rider amount then on their bill.
Correct. And, we're working on a refund plan right now and have not submitted that. But essentially the customers will get back the collection, the over-collection of an ROE that was being collected at 10.5, which will now be adjusted now to 9.45. So we will true that up and provide a refund to the customers. We have not at this point submitted the refund plan in terms of how exactly that'll show up, but in the past we've done it through bill credit.
And is that in addition to, so is that reflected in the overall lower increase, or, you know, is that more savings that isn't calculated in here?
That would be additional refunds that are not calculated in this reconciliation. This reconciliation is just to true up the general rate case application.
So if you looked at, like, residential customers, 5.2% or something overall increase they're going to be getting? No. What's the 3.7%?
That's overall, and then you were right on residential. 5.2. It's
5.2. Yep. So plus then they get a reduced, they're going to be saving some money, or is it just a smaller increase over on the riders?
So the 5.2 is on the general rate application,
yep.
And then they will get a refund on the riders separate from that.
Have you guys calculated what the net of that would be then?
The average customer, I don't know that. I've got a global number in total. I don't know that we've calculated that. Perhaps we have, and another witness could address that.
Isn't that important? I mean, that's part of the features of the rate case. It's more money they're saving. Or am I missing something here?
It's I guess the the general application, this would, what we represented here would be what came out of the general rate case request.
Yeah.
And then the rider true-up is a separate.
Okay. Well, I'll ask.
Okay.
I'll ask the advocacy staff more about that. Let's see here. Tell me about the I haven't really been able to. Oh, my gnome.
Yeah, there it goes.
UND.
Off with it.
Off with
Randy
it.
Randy likes him.
Yeah.
Now you're moving closer to him. I see how you. Yeah.
The fuel cost adjustment. Tell me how the settlement deals with that. Is there any specific treatment on that issue? Fuel costs.
As it relates to.
Anything. How is it treated in here, or is it not addressed?
Well, I think there was, as part of the settlement, we did agree to looking at the way we are submitting that and submitting it more often and giving more time, I believe. So there are some things that are noted in the settlement agreement. Let me see if I can find.
Here we go. So it says the company agrees to calculate its total fuel and purchase costs monthly versus two parts, with one being in base rates and the other being a monthly adjustment. So the whole fuel cost, there's none in base rates anymore? Under the settlement agreement, there's no fuel costs included in the base rates?
I don't believe so, but to get into the details of this adjustment, I would probably defer to another witness.
Okay. We maybe should just, because I'm a little confused by that and what that means, so maybe we can have whoever is an expert on that come up after you. Okay. Just make sure on the transmission rider, the the rider will continue to cover the regional transmission related expenses, which makes sense because those vary on a annual basis, but the transmission assets currently recovered in the rider will be moved. What are those? Which projects are those? Are those some smaller ones, or what do you have a general summary of those transmission ones?
Yeah, let's see here. I'm looking right now. If you want to ask me the next question while I try to find, maybe. I know we've got them in the testimony. I just am not finding it right now. There were two, I think there were two specific projects that we had in there.
Okay.
And I'm not.
And if one of the staff wants to find the page, they can, and I'll ask you the next one. Let's see here. The environmental rider, are you proposing to eliminate that or just keep it in case it's needed in the future for a future project? There won't be anything in it, correct?
Correct. After this? We are proposing to roll that into base rates.
And then the rider option will still exist, though, for the future.
I believe we would have to refile, or I'm not exactly sure how that technically would work, but all the assets within there will be moved into base rates.
And this might be something for the ARP, but I'll ask you. There was a fair amount of discussion by the ARP experts in their pre-filed stuff about customers that, based on the rate design, may not get, you know, the 5.2% increase. It might be significantly higher because of what kind of heating system they have, et cetera. Have you seen, as part of this discussion, any, what's the largest percentage increase a customer could potentially see as a result of this? Have you seen that discussion?
I have not.
Okay. That probably is something for the AARP to to comment on. Okay. Okay, then I just have a couple questions on the interim rates, and this is more philosophically than specific to the settlement, but how do interim rates and your ability to collect them reduce your risk as a company and for your investors?
How is that? Certainly when we look at the regulatory construct of North Dakota in terms of its ability to recover interim rates, that certainly does bear into reduced risk for the company. I would say, though, when you look at the overall risk as a component of, for instance, the return on equity that we would request in the case, there are numerous factors that you have to take into consideration, not just that one factor. But if you were to isolate just that factor, the ability to collect interim rates certainly is helpful and seen as a positive to the company. But there are other factors when operating in the state of North Dakota that need to be at play if you are talking about a global risk as it relates to return on equity requested.
Okay. Do you have the ability to collect interim rates in all of the 8 states you serve?
We do not.
Which ones don't have that?
Actually, we only have interim rates in 3 of our 8 states.
Okay. And so does that, the fact that you can't collect them in every state affect, does that minimize the importance of being able to in North Dakota? I mean, so you still have more risk in those others, which affects the company as a whole. So it's less valuable.
In the context of the entire company, certainly, but it's very valuable in the state of North Dakota.
Okay.
And we have a significant, in our 8 states, we have a significant presence in North Dakota. North Dakota is by far our biggest state.
Okay. And what was the ROE in your last rate, the ROE given to you in Montana in the case that you just completed with them most recently? What was the ROE they gave?
In Montana, did we state the ROE? I don't know if the ROE was stated for sure.
Okay. Where does the ROE in this settlement rank in terms of what you're collecting in your other states?
In terms of the overall settlement in context of the 9.65 and the true-up on ROEs, I would say it's within the range of what we're receiving in other states.
So middle of the range, higher?
About the average.
Average, okay. Okay, I think that's all my questions
okay.
for now. Thanks, Nicole.
Yep.
Chairman Christman.
Well, as usual, Commissioner Fedorchak was pretty thorough, so I don't have just too many left here, but you're going to get back to us on what the projects that are being switched on the transmission rider into base rate are, is that correct?
Yes, I'm looking. I know we have it in the testimony. I just am not finding it offhand. You,
if I may, Commissioner, Nicole, in Travis Jacobson's MDU, it's MDU Exhibit 14, page 7.
Okay, so thank you. The Kenmare to Lignite 115 kilovolt transmission line and the Little Muddy 60 kilovolt double circuit line. And that was built to create a loop around Williston, the Little Muddy. So I believe you've got the testimony in front of you as well, but as they mentioned, Travis has got it in his.
And then roughly, how much does that change that transmission rider then? If their current bill is $5, do these comprise a big part of that $5 of their transmission rider? Or is this just a very small part of what's in the transmission rider?
The transmission rider, what we're saying now as part of this settlement is the investments would move to base rates and then the expense would stay in the rider. And as an example, I believe, in discussions here within the company, the difference in expense between, for instance, 15 and 16 in total was around $800,000. So, again, that would have been spread across, you know, all of our customers. So the transmission rider, I would characterize it as a small percentage of the overall bill for a customer, if that's what you were asking.
No, I don't, not
okay.
Really. There are other projects in that transmission rider currently, correct?
I believe those are the only two.
Those are the only two?
Correct.
Also, okay, I thought this was two out of several and that the others were not being shifted.
No, Montana Dakota included two transmission projects for recovery under the TCA approved in case number PU15747, which were the two I mentioned.
Okay, so that clarifies that. And then in their original testimony,
yep.
Advocacy staff was pretty hard on the company in your planning and decision-making on the rice units. Now a lot of that is being allowed back in, but when Mr. Shook takes the stand, I'm going to be asking him, well, okay, before you thought it was really poor decision-making, and now you're allowing it, what changed your mind? And so in advance of that, do you want to give your thoughts on that process? Because I will tell you, as when I read through that part of advocacy staff's original filings, I was very concerned, too, that as much time as it did pass after the Bakken was exploding, and it seemed like rather suddenly there was the realization for needing to move quickly and not very many options to move that quickly. And so I'd like to just give you a chance to respond in advance of his response.
Right. And, you know, certainly as we look back in time on the Bakken, and I believe Alan and Darcy both covered this very well in their rebuttal then to the advocacy staff's testimony here, you know, without the benefit of hindsight, we were in the heat of the moment in the Bakken. And I think to take us back in time, sometimes it's hard to do when we sit here today and we know what's going on out there. But when we were in a situation where the company was at, where we were forced to make a decision to lose firm service to our customers or take action and build the rice units, I believe we made the right decision. When I think about the Christmas storm that you referenced earlier and the worry and concern you have when you have customers out for multiple days, that is not something that we like to do. Our number one priority is safe and reliable service for our customers. We did explore multiple options, as were laid out very well in the rebuttal testimony, in terms of other ways that we could ensure that we don't disrupt service to our customers in that load pocket. And this was determined to be the best option for our customers. Albeit, you know, at the time, Bakken costs were expensive. We had to accelerate the project. All the considerations that went into play were at play, but we also had service that we needed to provide to our customers. And so I believe we made the right decision at that time with everything that we had going on. And Darcy and Alan, like I said, in their rebuttal covered off on the specifics of that.
It seems like the starting point always is more around 2014 or so, but in years, say, 2010 and 11 and 12, when things were really taking off out there, and I will certainly acknowledge that I don't know of anyone who predicted the growth being as fast as it
right.
turned out to be, but you could sure see in years like 2010, 11, and 12 that it was exploding. So whose responsibility was it to see that it could get to a point where the transmission that you were relying on to get power up there that ended up going to the co-ops instead in large part would probably not be able to keep up? Is that solely MDU's responsibility to have been looking ahead that far? Is that something that your RTO should have caught, that, you know, this may not be reliable in this environment? Or who should have or could have seen that before 2014 and planned earlier?
Yeah, I think, you know, all parties were at the table. All parties were trying to do their best to make an estimate of what the demand was going to be out there. And I think, as you mentioned and admitted, I don't know that anybody dreamt it was going to be what it was. And so I don't want to sit here today and try to point fingers at who, you know, where in the process it went wrong in terms of was somebody solely responsible for being able to predict what was going to happen in terms of the transmission facilities out there. And as you mentioned, we were reliant on WAPA and Basin, and their load growth was exploding faster than ours. As I mentioned, we were at a 10% of the overall growth we were serving, which leaves the RECs to, you know, essentially, you know, serve the remainder. And so there were a lot of factors at play. It was there was a lot going on, and you know, unfortunately, no one predicted it was going to explode as fast as it did. So,
but your contract, you always knew with Western, terminated in 2015, correct?
I believe that's correct. Yep.
And so, is it a company's responsibility to figure out how they're going to keep things operating, or is that largely shifted to RTOs? And
I think we have responsibility to ensure that we can provide service to our customers. I wouldn't want to say that we don't have that responsibility. I mean, we need to look at that. I think with the shifting and moving variables at play, there were just a lot of factors looking backwards at it that, you know, went into play in terms of, you know, what we were going to do to keep the lights on for our customers out there. And essentially it was a load pocket concern, right? It was, you know, there was constraints there. And so, you know, we looked at all the different variables as laid out in terms of what our options were and executed what we felt was the best option.
Okay. Then moving to the decommissioning costs.
Yes.
Wind is separate, right?
Correct.
You have a separate decommissioning.
We have decommissioning for wind, yeah. Correct.
Okay, and in some of your other states, you have a decommissioning fund for the other generation as well, correct?
We do.
And is that amount, I don't know what the term for it would be, when you came up with the $1.9 million that you proposed in the rate case, that's the amount that you expect would be adequate in the long term to cover it, I presume.
Correct.
So in the other states, do you collect an amount similar to that or a reduced rate more similar to this $500,000 that would be allowed in the settlement?
So the estimates that we were using to come up with our decommissioning in total are the estimates were similarly used across the states. In Montana, we are essentially fully recovered, so we would be in a different position here than we would be in North Dakota.
So the $1.9 million was not like a catch-up thing. That was just what should be being collected all along. And so now we're only collect this in the settlement, we would only be collecting about a fourth as much as what really ought to be being collected?
That is correct.
So what's the long-term plan for that then at this rate that we're just going to at some point get to the end of some major facilities and have a generational shift where the future generations have to not only pay for the future generation of people have to not only pay for the new generation of electricity plus pay for our decommissioning costs?
So basically what we'll do, so in terms of to get to maybe your first question, what's the plan for that? I think we need to continue to monitor, you know, what the right move is for decommissioning. And I would say we're not just going to wait until we're at a retirement of a facility. And then so in our next general, we will continue to approach decommissioning as a topic with this commission. So that would be our plan, is to continue to look at opportunities to account for that in our rate structure. Okay. As a part of this settlement, we agreed to start the process, basically.
Okay, and I am also not an accountant, so I don't understand the descriptions of what happens with this $500,000. Now, you collect it, and somewhere in the advocacy staff comments, they had expressed concern, well, if there were a bankruptcy or something, that money would just be gone. It wouldn't be there then for decommissioning. So in the settlement, how's it being accounted for, and what's the assurance that the people who are paying it in have that it will, in fact, be made available some way or down the line for decommissioning, not used for something else?
Yeah, so I guess to maybe get to that concern, you're getting to the concern is, will the funds, you know, be available in the future? Is that
correct?
Right.
And explanation of how we may.
And essentially, you know, when we look at our, you know, balance sheet as an overall company, we are not going to be running our business so tight such that, you know, we don't have cash and funds available. I am not aware that these dollars are being, if you're indicating, like deposited into some sort of account where they cannot be touched. I don't believe that's the case, but I would probably ask another witness to address specifically how the dollars are being collected. But we will be setting up a liability for a future payment of the decommissioning. And so it is on the books of the company. It's not that we're not accounting for it on the in the overall records of the company, if that's the concern.
Well, so I know nobody ever likes to talk about it, but I think there are times when the worst-case scenarios need to be talked about. So you would just then be carrying you'd have more assets, but you'd have
correct.
More liabilities now. And so if there were a bankruptcy, those assets would be spread amongst all of your liabilities. And so if this liability were 2% of all of your liabilities, all this money that was collected for decommissioning, only 2% of it would probably wind up into the decommissioning availability.
Yeah, I guess in the event of a bankruptcy, to your point, we would use our assets that we have to recover our liabilities. There would be some sort, I mean, in the total doomsday scenario, I would assume there would be liquidation of the assets. There would maybe be a purchase by another company. So it seems like it would be, you know, it would have to be a real doomsday scenario where we would be in a position where we could not come up with this $500,000 that would have been deposited by our customers here in the state of North Dakota to pay decommissioning of these facilities. It would have to be a, you know, a real challenge situation. I have a hard time envisioning that.
Is that just an unheard of thought that it, to lock it away somewhere separately? Is there examples of that with other investor-owned utilities in other states, or is
I am not aware of that, but there may be other examples, but I am not aware of that.
Thank you, Your Honor. No other questions, and thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Mr. Crushes.
Well, a number of my questions were on the decommissioning fund as well, just simply because it started at a little over 1.9 and wound up at 500,000. Yep. Will accrued interest be or interest be accrued on that amount? But it almost sounds like the answer is no if there isn't a defined strategy in terms of where those funds will reside.
I do not believe interest is being accrued, but perhaps with the questions around decommissioning, we can call another expert who can talk in more detail on that, but I do not believe there is interest being accrued.
All right. I think that's important because, in effect, it becomes a 0% operating loan if the money is not put in reserve and no interest is applied, you know, for the benefit of customers.
I think, though, you know, in our rebuttal, our response to that, though, was essentially what it's doing, though, is reducing rate base. So the customer is getting full credit on an ROR, not just on interest. They're getting the full credit on ROR because the rate base that we're charging them on is lower. So it is you know, hitting revenue, it's hitting expense, we're building up a liability, and it's reducing rate base. So in a future rate case, our customers are not being charged for that amount, and they're getting the benefit of a complete return, rate of return, not just interest. So I think that's really the way we're looking at it as a company.
Mm-hmm. With $1.9 million not being what I would assume it wasn't an arbitrary amount. It was done with extensive calculations in play, that type of thing. Going down to $500,000, this is similar to Commissioner Christman's question on, and I hate to use the terminology kicking the can down the road, but I would like to see more detail on what that could potentially mean. But correct me if I'm wrong, did you indicate no projects have been specifically identified, that this is more general in nature?
Yeah, I think maybe what you're alluding to is my comment over the foreseeable future here. We do not have, and nor have we announced any retirements of any of our facilities. So, there's no immediate need per se.
And then included in terms of more detail, just to know how often those funds would be reviewed, since they will come into play again in all likelihood in future rate cases.
Right. So each time we go and file a general, we look at these things. And so certainly it will be considered within the next general rate case in terms of not only, where we're currently at, but our overall estimate on whether the estimate is still a good estimate in terms of decommissioning costs in total. All those things are considered.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Mr. Sanderson, any redirect?
Your Honor, if we may we take a short break?
Yes.
We want to decide what witnesses we need to address.
Right. I was trying to decide whether we wanted to finish with this witness before we take that break or not. Oh. But I think it's a good time for a break. We'll come back at 10 o'clock. It'll be about a 10-minute break. They'll give you an opportunity to regroup and see if we can get this answer.
Your Honor, I will have one more question. Okay.
We'll go around again when we come back.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Sanderson, back on the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. And just for the record, before we continue, Montana Dakota will be calling Travis Jacobson and Darcy Nigam after we're finished with Ms. Cavisto to address some of the questions in more detail that the commissioners had. With that, just to continue, Ms. Cavisto, you were asked about the $7.5 million revenue increase and the impact that the lower 9.45 ROE true-ups on the riders may have. Could you just explain in more detail the impact of those on the two?
Yeah, I guess the clarification that I'd like to make on that is the 7.5 revenue requirement is a net number. So essentially the riders that we are continuing with, which would be the renewable rider, the transmission rider, and again the generation rider with respect to Rice, those riders are actually seeing decreases and then the overall revenue request is an increase. And so I just want to be clear that it is a net number. And then separate from that, as I previously mentioned, and again separate from that, is the true-up on the riders at the 9.45%. So just to be clear.
And Ms. Cavisto, the $7.5 million revenue increase in the rate application, that's on a going forward
basis,
correct?
Correct.
And the 9.45 true-ups are credits that will be issued on past recoveries that Montana Dakota has made?
That is correct.
Okay. With that, no further questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
No questions.
Okay, commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, I forgot the one I was going to ask before we broke, but now I have a new one. So that one will come back to me maybe when Travis is up here. So
So the true-up, thank you for that explanation on the 9.45% revenue or ROE and how that will apply to past rates. And then it's also applying moving forward, too.
On rice, correct.
Just on rice.
Correct.
Okay. And so you still don't know what the dollar, what that value is to customers, though, in terms of a dollar amount that will be trued up, like, how much have you basically over-collected from customers over the past couple of years, and how much will they be saving, I guess, moving forward?
I do not have that exact number in front of me. If we can get that, another witness will present that. I have a number that we've discussed in total, but I do not have a per-customer number at this time.
And what was the total amount?
The total was, it was over $2 million, I thought, but again...
Oh, that's right. Is that listed
nope,
in
that's
list?
Not
no,
on,
that's separate.
Yep,
okay.
The true up on the riders is separate.
All right. Okay. That would be good to know, that number. That's it. Thanks, Kate.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Christman.
So my one question morphed into two, but is Travis going to talk about decommissioning?
Correct.
Okay. So that's one of them. I'll just wait with that.
Okay.
But the other one, going back to your discussion with Commissioner Dvorak. If I understood you correctly, you said that other than Thunder Spirit 2, you saw no plans for additional generation in the next 5 years, correct?
That is correct.
Have I misunderstood something along the way outside of this case, but just in general discussions? Was MDU not involved in planning as a potential partner or something and potentially some gas baseload power in the northwest part of the state, and is that all gone now, or what's
we
the
are
plan with that?
Yep, thanks for the question. We are still evaluating a combined cycle natural gas generation facility. However, I don't see that taking place in the next 5 years, for example. But yes, we are still actively pursuing that as the next generation resource, and there'll be more details in our IRP, but I don't see that occurring within the next 4 to 5 years.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Crashes.
No other questions.
Okay. You may step down.
Thank you.
At this time, Montana Dakota would call Travis Jacobson.
Good morning, Mr. Jacobson. You were here when I gave the perjury admonition?
I was.
Okay. You raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Jacobson. Could you please state your full name and business address?
My name is Travis Jacobson, and my business address is 400 North 4th Street in Bismarck.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota?
I'm a manager in the Regulatory Affairs Department.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities as manager of the Regulatory Affairs?
I am primarily responsible for the monthly fuel and natural gas pass-ons, as well as the development of the revenue requirement in this case.
And just briefly, Mr. Jacobson, could you describe your educational background?
I am an accountant. CPA and a bachelor's degree in accounting.
And just a brief background of your work experience.
I've worked for Montana Dakota for about 20 years.
And have you testified in proceedings in this state and other states before?
Yes, I have.
And you're familiar with Montana Dakota's application in this proceeding?
I am.
And what was your involvement in the application?
Primarily on the revenue requirement calculation.
And, Mr. Jacobson, you were present when some questions were asked of Ms. Cavisto earlier, but specifically, could you explain or provide a little more detail as to how the monthly fuel cost adjustment will be treated under the settlement agreement that was entered into?
Okay. So a little background on that. We do our monthly fuel cost calculation every month, and we will continue to do that. In past rate cases, there has been an established base amount of fuel. And then every month we trued up to that fuel. So the proposal in the settlement is to do away with the base and just to present the total fuel charge in the customer's bill. Administratively, there's really not a lot of difference. It's more of a presentation. Our computation will be very similar to it has been in the past, but rather than have two components, as noted, there is a base and then adjustment two to get to our total. It'll just be a fuel amount.
And Mr. Jacobson, you also heard there was a number of questions regarding decommissioning and how that is treated from an accounting standpoint. Could you just provide a little more background and information regarding how Montana Dakota treats the decommissioning fund as part of this settlement?
Okay. So in order to establish the $1.9 million we had originally requested in rates, what we did is we contracted with some engineering consultants to provide an estimate of the costs net of any salvage to decommission each of our generating units. Then we tried to get an estimate of the remaining life of each of those units and then amortized it over that. So that was the genesis of the $1.9 million. We also used that similar method in South Dakota, and as Nicole had mentioned, in Montana, we've had decommissioning for probably 40 years, and so they are fully funded in terms of decommissioning. As a part of the settlement, the amount was reduced from $1.9 million down to $500,000. The one thing that I guess I would just mention, within each of our other asset classes, there can be decommissioning costs as well. However, in those cases, it's treated just within, it's a component of the depreciation rate. So the production assets are the only assets where we didn't have a component in the depreciation rate that is applied to those asset balances. The reason that we chose to do the amortization is Matt's project at Lewis and Clark would be a good example. The value of that plant increased substantially with the addition of the MATS project. So if you apply a percentage rate, it actually, you'll over-collect relative to the amount you need, which is why we chose to do a straight amortization, even though the value of MATS added cost to that overall plant, it really doesn't increase the cost of decommissioning in that same relationship. In terms of how we would true that up, as we incur costs to decommission a part of a plant or a plant in total, those costs would be incurred and then they would offset this fund that we're setting up to pay for the decommissioning. And again, the decommissioning should match the time frame the plant is in service. In particular to the production assets of Montana Dakota, historically North Dakota has not had any decommissioning on those assets. We would not anticipate we would assign the decommissioning to a particular plant, but it would just be available as a liability, offsetting rate base, and then it would be used for the decommissioning. And I think Nicole summed it up pretty well in that there isn't an interest component applied to a balance. In certain industries, I think they do set it aside, for instance, in the nuclear. But there you're talking billions of dollars, and they have it set up, set aside. They actually have like fund managers that go out and manage those funds to get a return on them. In our particular case, no different than any other depreciation rate, it reduces your overall rate base and therefore it reduces the overall revenue requirement that the customer is responsible for.
Mr. Jacobson, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
I have one, just one, I think. But can you explain why you had started your background on the decommissioning saying for other assets it is part of, like, depreciation? Mm-hmm. So maybe oversimplified, but that's how I understand it. So why was it not in the situation we're talking about here, not part of depreciation?
Primarily due to the fact that as your gross plant balance increases, then your collection amount by applying a static percentage would also increase. But your cost of decommissioning may remain relatively flat. So my understanding is many years ago, the North Dakota Commission did not allow recovery. So it just kind of has
entrenched.
We've been in that spot. So in this particular case, we followed what we did in Montana and in South Dakota in setting up an amortization rather than applying it on a percentage basis as a component of depreciation.
And what mechanisms are you using in those other states for collecting reserve? I mean, are they all going to be the same in all states then, the sort of mechanism for collecting and how you're accounting for it, or are they different?
So in South Dakota, the mechanism would be very similar to what we have proposed in North Dakota. And in Montana, again, the decommissioning had been approved decades ago, so that's fully funded.
Thank you. That's all.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
Thank you, Travis. I missed when you said which assets the company has already basically collected depreciation costs through the depreciation method.
So for poles, for instance.
Transmission stuff?
Yep.
So none of the generation assets, though?
Correct. No generation.
Okay. So there isn't anything else really that needs to be collected for decommissioning, like office buildings and stuff. Do you apply this to that?
No.
No. So it's just your generation assets and transmission.
What we're proposing, the $500,000, would only be for generation
right,
assets.
Right, because the transmission stuff is already done through depreciation.
Through depreciation, that's correct.
Okay. But none of the generation assets have. And the total estimates from your engineers for decommissioning all of your generation assets was $1.9 million.
The total would have been, the top of my head, about $30 million. And then what we did is we had a life of each plant to establish an annual revenue requirement.
The North Dakota portion of that wasn't the $30 million, or was that the North Dakota portion?
It would have been about 70% of that $30 million.
Okay. Okay. On the fuel cost issue, was this an idea that you guys wanted, or did the advocacy staff want you to stop having a base fuel a base charge in rates for fuel and then basically true it up monthly? Was this your idea or theirs?
This was not what we had proposed.
Okay.
However, we don't have any issues with it. We currently do that on the gas side where there is no base and you true up. It doesn't impact the way we calculate it. I think it simplifies the presentation.
Okay, so it's easier for customers to understand what they're actually being charged and paying.
I would agree.
So you backed out the cost of the base rate for fuel from base rates?
So there's a few complications. So if you say
of course
base
there are
rates... I guess if you're talking about When we bill a customer, there's the demand component, the customer basic service charge, and then their energy component. Fuel has been and will continue to be a separate line.
Mm-hmm.
So base rate is basically, we're just saying that about 2.5 cents is what the fuel would be. And then you'd true up to your actuals from that base fuel. So it really doesn't have anything to do with...
It never was in base rates, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Oh, well, that's confusing. Even Jerry thought it was in base rates.
Fuel has been presented as a separate line on the bill. It's only fuel.
Okay, so basically, let's keep it simple. Customers maybe paid $5 no matter what for fuel, and then you'd add on their use on top of that. And now what you're saying is you're just doing straight use, period. There was no minimum charge or base charge. I see heads shaking no in the background. So obviously that's wrong, so you better correct me.
So for every kilowatt hour, there is a per unit charge. And
right.
That is how it used to be. That's how it is now. It's just a presentation. Before, we would have said your base amount of fuel is 2.5 cents, but we had more wind, so now it's 2.25. So you'd had two pieces. You'd have said 2.5 less a quarter to get to 2.25. Now we present it as 2.25.
Okay. So this is going to be simpler.
And I think you're getting hung
whoever
up
whoever came
on
up with that idea, why did you do it that other way? That seems kind of crazy.
I got to look back. It has been that way for a long time, and I guess I don't know why it was this done that way. But.
I'm trying to stump the chump. How can we make this as confusing as possible? This is better. Thank you. I don't have any more questions.
Chairman Cressman.
My question was answered in the testimony, so I don't
think you're looking at your bill there. I'm not sure.
I was.
That's smart.
Commissioner Carlshus.
No other questions.
Okay.
Nothing further, John.
Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako, she has one.
Well, I don't have a question, but I would like you to please say what MATS is, please. Explain MATS. We have some new people.
It's the Mercury Air Toxic Standards. It is a pollution control project that was done at the Lewis and Clark station.
That's all. Thank you.
Okay. You could step down, Mr. Jacobson.
At this time, Montana Dakota would call Darcy Nigam.
Mr. Nigam, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding? Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Nigam. Could you please state your full name and business address?
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota Utilities, 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota?
I'm the Director of Electric System Operations and Planning.
And could you just briefly explain what your daily responsibilities include?
Sure. Among other things, I'm responsible for the operation of our electric transmission control center, also our resource planning activities, both on the generation side and on the transmission side.
And could you briefly describe your educational background?
Sure. I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in electrical engineering and also a Master's of Business Administration.
And briefly describe your work experience.
My work experience, I've been employed with Montana Dakota Utilities for 21 years in various roles, from originally in one of our power plants and then getting into more development of generation resources, and the last 12 years on the system operations and planning side.
And Mr. Nigam, you've testified before this commission and other state regulatory bodies before?
Yes, I have.
And you're familiar with Montana Dakota's application in this case, and you filed both direct and rebuttal testimony, correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Now, you were here present earlier during Ms. Cavisto's examination when there were some questions raised regarding the rice units, the timing of those, and the impact of some of the contracts with other third parties that those had on the decision to support the Montana Dakota's decision to construct the rice project. Could you just explain to the commission what led to the decision-making process for the company to choose rice?
Sure, I can do that. So the question was around the impacts of the contract that we had with Western Area Power Administration around transmission service, and at least the impacts on some of the planning activities, particularly for transmission up in the Bakken region. Montana Dakota Utilities is transmission dependent upon the facilities of Western and Basin for deliveries up into the area. We don't have any facilities that directly provide or provide a transmission path up into that Williston Bakken area. We do own facilities within it. Most of those would be lower voltage, 115 kV voltage facilities, which are more of just delivery facilities among some of the communities that we end up serving. From the standpoint of a transmission planning process, that would, at least when the Bakken activities were taking off, that would have all been under Western Area Power Administration's tariff. They were not inside a regional transmission or RTO at that point. So from a transmission planning side, they did run their own, what would be a FERC 890 planning process, which would govern what they need to study and how they conduct those. We would have ended up being a customer of that, so would not be at the table when it's conducted or end up being a part of their study. We would end up seeing the results as far as once they're produced, as everyone else would as a customer. From a standpoint of, you know, when we take a look at the impact of that agreement expiring, that agreement that we had with Western, which was we would call our transmission service agreement, the expiration of that we had known about and really did not have a bearing as far as on the planning as it went. What had happened already as our loads grew, we ended up having to take additional service under Western's tariff as an incremental customer for network transmission service. And what was contemplated is those same facilities that they had built many years ago and were building when the Bakken was being developed, those facilities then would provide service to all of our customers, was anticipated under their integrated systems tariff or IIS tariff. So our service would have just moved from a fixed contract rate that we had over to a full tariff service. And they would have continued to have planned for that under their tariff up until such time as they made the decision to join an RTO, which kind of coincided when they joined Southwest Power Pool to the timing of the expiration of that agreement. But they would have continued to have served that load up until that point. And so Montana Dakota had seen the increase in load forecasts, you know, for our own customers that we planned, we submitted to those as a part of their planning process. The bigger driver or impact was the increases that continued in the REC load forecast, where our load forecast continued to hold what we ended up seeing for our customer actual loads as they came in. Those load forecasts for the rural electric cooperatives kept changing. And so the needs for more and more projects or closeness to the place where constraints or limitations on the transmission system had to be mitigated by other means, large case local generation or transmission buildouts, those drivers for that were not necessarily in the changes of our forecast, which is only 10% of all the growth, but that continued change of the REC forecast, which had a big impact on Western's transmission planning process and their ability to serve all the load that was up in the Bakken region.
Am I correct that that issue came to a head in July of 2014?
It did. So in July of 2014, we had already seen 1 or 2 years at least of the base forecast that had been submitted, at least ours remaining true to what we had forecasted, that theirs continued to change. And one thing that happens when we talk about the REC forecast, they all submit them separately. So you get a collection of 4 or 5 of them. So it isn't that Basin's forecasting their loads. It's the co-ops are providing their own forecast based upon new customers come into them. So in aggregate is all of those cooperatives up there give their forecast, and it changes by 100 to 200 megawatts each year looking out. It keeps driving the overall impact and the need for some of the transmission solutions that we were aware of. At least the timing for those become needed sooner and sooner and sooner. And based upon the means that we ended up seeing in 2014 for the lack in available capacity on the transmission system with all generation running, we were at a place of being at a point and looking out for the winter of 2015-16, you know, being in a place even under system intact conditions of not being able to serve all of our load under peak conditions due to a lack of available transmission by Western and Basin.
And so, and I understand that we were, Montana Dakota was advised in roughly July of 2014 that there may not be enough energy to support its customers in 2015-2016. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. What decision then did the company, or what options did the company pursue to make sure it could provide safe and reliable power to its customers in the winter of 2015-2016?
So we had already done a number of other program additions or expansions to help take care of if there were situations where there would be load curtailments. You know, we had identified previously an amount of load that was potentially at risk for curtailments, mainly for prior transmission outages. Those were increases in our customer demand response programs that we had targeted, so at least customers who were willing to interrupt their loads first. We also had contracted with the city of Williston on two projects they undertook, at least to be able to run dispatch some of their standby generation that would basically generate back into our system. We also had looked for other ways that we could get credit under Western's methodology they were using to determine how their firm transmission service was allotted. We had some abilities to get credit from some additional generation output at the Lewis and Clark station. If we'd run it on natural gas, we can get more output. And we also had an ability we had identified to shift some of our load, if needed, out of the Bakken region, so at least to be able to use that as a mitigation effort. We also had taken opportunities to move some mobile generators that we did have and looked at installed some of those sort of as a peaking, kind of the last resources we'd look to run. So in that case, we had looked at a number of other mitigating efforts over the years, and it also had a couple of purchase arrangements with Basin to share in some of their delivery either into the system or to be able to have them provide redispatching service to us. And in that winter of 2015-2016, as the REC forecast changed, particularly the ability to use the redispatch service agreements that we had previously used as a first means to serve our customer load in these less than firm conditions, that was going to be unavailable because they just didn't have that margin anymore. So it became for us to look as saying, what could we end up doing, at least to install local resources? Because for us to build transmission, the schedule wasn't long enough and it would be cost prohibitive to build our own transmission up into that area. And so we turned and took a look at other sites, you know, potentially to build generation in the area. Some of that was through partnership conversations that we'd end up having up in the Bakken region. And the other one was looking at areas either for greenfield or brownfield sites. And so looking at a couple of other places, particularly the Watford City area, potentially for other generation, would also help in some other transmission second sources in the area, would have been a greenfield site, which would have taken more time and likely been significantly more expensive. We ultimately looked at the Lewis and Clark station as a place because of available gas transmission and employees to end up constructing a facility at that location in an effort to minimize total schedule impact and also to reduce total cost of our greenfield site.
And ultimately, Montana Dakota determined the construction of the RICE units at the Lewis and Clark station was the best option to provide additional and reliable power to its customers?
That is correct.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
No questions.
Commissioners, Commissioner Fedorchik.
Thank you, Darcy. Can you tell me what stage was that big 365 kV or 345 kV? Line that Basin built from Antelope Valley to Neset. What stage was that in during all of this discussion? And would that have provided, if it was completed in time, would that have solved the problem for you?
So the construction of Basin's 345 KV line from ABS to Neset was kind of in the planning and the works. I think some of the earlier indications we saw of that were in like 2010, 2011. And ultimately, it was seen to provide, you know, the overall need for another large source into the area. So that project was on the horizon for quite a while, you know, 5 to 6 years, which is typically what it would take for a large project of that size. And that was one of the pieces when we looked at from a transmission customer standpoint as us seeing what the solution was to provide firm service into the area. So we were certainly well apprised of the project, you know, of its, at least from a planning standpoint, 2010, 2011, and seeing its need. As the forecast continued to grow, the need for that project became bigger and bigger, and its importance sooner, you know, became more critical.
If that had been completed by 2015, would you not have needed this? Could you have solved your problem without the units?
No, because the concern ended up being, even with the construction of that project, what we ended up seeing in this 2014, July of 2014, is that with the load growths that were projected, all of the incremental transmission service capability that was perceived to have been available, system intact, was all going to be gone. And so there was
what the incremental is, I guess, so incremental from where to where.
Like, so typically when you would build a transmission project, you know, you have generally more capacity than what you end up needing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say you overbuild, but those assets come in lumpy in size. And in the case of that project, it was supposed to provide significant load-serving capabilities for several years. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening was the project was needed on a particular date, and there was no excess transmission service capability that would be, at least in the area, that'd be available.
Even with that project?
Even with
Basin
that.
Basin was using all of it?
Even with that project. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they were into the second phase of that, almost immediately behind it, because the first project wasn't big enough.
Right.
And the other issue you get into is with the outage of that project or any other transmission facilities, the load serving capability becomes less and less. So you build this large 345 kV project, but if it's delayed or if there's an outage on it that falls down, you're right back to where you were before.
Mm-hmm. Basin was expanding in the same area in Wofford City and Williston during these same years and adding some, you know, 600 megawatts, I believe, ultimately they added of peaking units. Did you look at just tacking on to some of those or working in cooperation with them on some of those units in Williston or Wofford City?
So in 2014, we did have conversations with them, signed some confidentiality agreements to talk about development of further generation resources. You know, they did share some of their plans for the future, as did we and our needs. One of the concerns we had with them was the overall timing. You know, they were not able to find facilities, at least to have online for the winter of 2015-2016. They were already looking out beyond that. So as far as from their planning standpoint was to put all their eggs in the basket of saying they were going to get the transmission project done, or they were just going to have to deal with the issues of being short generation. From our standpoint, the place that placed us is the incremental generation that we were able to purchase from them would be unavailable. And so we had a significantly larger impact, you know, that we would have had to have mitigated, thus the need for the rice for that winter of 2015-2016.
But couldn't have you just added, say, another 20 megawatts onto what they were already planning for their own needs?
So one of the complexities we had in visiting with them, you know, one of the areas that they looked at connect to one of their members distribution systems, which was not open access. It was considered distribution. So we weren't able to connect to that facility. Some of the other places they were looking to construct with, at least at that point, being under WAPA's IF's tariff and not being in an RTO, it becomes the complexity of how do you dispatch a partnership-owned unit. One, we're in MISO, all of our load. You know, we would want to get delivery into MISO. How then do you partner in a new facility either that's under Western's IS tariff or under SPP's tariff? In which case they talked about joining. We just didn't know very well how a join-owned unit, at least, you know, that would serve two RTOs would work out.
So they were. It was more of a contractual issue.
The contractual issue plus also their schedule that they had.
So you have the RICE units up in operation. How are they performing?
Very well. And actually they ran quite a bit last fall and even into last summer just with some of the transmission outages in western North Dakota. They were called on to run by MISO sometimes every day throughout the week and sometimes even around the clock.
Mm. And if you were to go back and look at that investment at a time when you aren't in a rush, is that the type of unit you'd pick?
It would have been, because even we had looked at that technology as a part of our integrating resource plan. And so that type of technology was actually identified, at least for consideration for new peaking resources.
And is that would you potentially add more of those same units in that area, at that same location?
So one of the concerns we ultimately had was certainly the size of the total project we built. Because certainly, you know, we knew we were constructing in an area where construction costs were very high, you know, by what contractors and construction costs were in the Bakken. Of looking at constructing more units, certainly there'd be economies of scale, but the total project cost would have been higher. And also it got into the question of one on a schedule, could we have gotten it done? And the other place that we were concerned about was the amount of incremental transmission that was available on the system out there that we could hook up without some sort of network upgrades.
But is that a location moving forward that you could add on to?
Yes, we could.
Okay. The transmission issues wouldn't prevent you from doing that?
If we would add more resources, particularly at Lewis and Clark, we'd have to commission a transmission study and see what's incrementally available. We had anticipated at least, you know, it was possible to at least install two more units there, you know, potentially based upon, at least when we initially looked at that, what was available transmission.
Two more, what are they, 9 megawatts?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Darcy.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Chrisman.
So with either WAPA or Basin Electric as a customer, do you have a responsibility or even a right to have been lobbying them in those earlier years if it was your feeling that they were not getting their projections right and that there was all this growth and you had contracts whereby you might not get the electricity that you need?
So we certainly were, you know, at the tables with them, if not, you know, annually, at least semi-annually or quarterly, looking at what their projections were, particularly as their updates came along. And it was certainly something, you know, they wanted to share because certainly with, you know, potentials for curtailments for the seasons, they wanted to get that information out to customers so they could end up making plans or at least have mitigation efforts. One of the challenges that we had with Western and Basin not being in an RTO and having their own tariff, you know, you're kind of at limits, at least to how they decide that they want to write their tariff and how they decide they want to allocate additional service that they have. So you're constantly working with them to figure out, you know, what's the next rule change they're going to end up making on you. And one of the places we kept fighting for was the timing of our load forecasts, where initially we were one of the last ones to come in and see the impacts of the growth because we didn't serve the actual oil rigs in the field themselves looking at the communities. They got their initial forecasts in before us as they heard from suppliers. So at least from a timing standpoint, when they were prioritizing loads, they start looking at the REC load forecast coming in first and get the higher priorities to serve. We're at the tail end. The one thing that changed for us as their forecast kept changing, the priorities to serve our loads kept coming higher and higher, and that's what we kept an eye on, trying to fight for that. What they would establish of rules is saying we're the last to get served. Now all of a sudden we were getting close to being the middle of the pack, and that's why we were seeing the build-out of the 345 kV transmission line would take care of a lot of these needs, and at least we could avoid having to build costly transmission or at least, you know, generation in an area at least where the construction costs were going to be significantly higher.
So now WAPA and Basin are in an RTO, but it's not the same one as you. And so does that change much, or are you still just as much kind of in the position as just being a customer and not a lot of bargaining power?
So we're actually in a good position, and one of the reasons for that, we didn't know at the time in 2014 what their membership was going to be and how it would work out, if we'd be in MISO, if we'd have to go to Southwest Power Pool. When we ended up filing our intervention, and they're filing to join SPP and ultimately our settlement agreement of how we take transmission service up there, you know, we did everything that we could to make sure that we were protected and our loads are served on the same basis as theirs up there in the Bakken region. So when we look at SPP's tariff, because we're taking transmission service from them for network transmission service, our loads are served on that same priority that Basin, their members, and Western's customers are. So the playing field has levelized now.
So curtailments would impact MDU no more severely than the distribution co-ops up there?
That's right.
And we're talking about both your Basin load as well as WAPA. Right. We're talking the same thing here.
Yes.
Okay, and then so that's a significant change. There's that and the rice unit being added, but beyond that, how do we make sure that we're doing the right amount of planning for long term if things continue to grow up there?
So the planning that continues, you know, now is under an RTO planning process. And so you don't end up with just one or two entities that are kind of doing, but they're planning by themselves and sharing it. One of the other things that's occurred is, you know, the second phase of the ABS to Neset, you know, 345 line has been completed. And so there's an even additional more transmission servicing capability that's available that was present, you know, prior to the winter of 2015, 2016. So at least some of that margin that was lost has been restored, and at least there's an ability, looking at total capability, to serve that load under not only system attack but under prior outage conditions.
And any discussions about a combined cycle plant being more than 5 years out, we heard, if things should start to grow suddenly up there and we can't wait that long and have to add rice units or something more quickly, is that the responsibility of both RTOs, both MISO and SPP, to be looking at that and making sure that we're getting the plan right further out in advance, or is it on MDU as well?
The predominant planning is by both RTOs, and certainly it is incumbent upon us to monitor, you know, what they come up with plans and taking a look at what's being proposed and making sure that we end up seeing that, you know, that's adequate, or if we have concerns that we, you know, interject those into the planning processes.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
My question centered largely on what was just covered in terms of being adequately positioned for future growth. Should oil prices rebound, recognizing that the number of active drilling rigs, number of active rigs in the Bakken region, that still remains a constant, and that continues to grow. They don't those rigs. Don't go away when prices decline necessarily. But did you factor in, in terms of future growth, the likelihood that construction costs would decline in the Bakken over the course of time? There were so many resources steered toward infrastructure build-out. Labor was difficult. Materials were difficult to access. Was that a part of the planning? And in effect, will that benefit customers going forward if you do have to ramp up more quickly than anticipated in the future?
So from a region standpoint, I think there's a significant, certainly, you know, an investment of facilities and infrastructure, you know, largely to take care of what caused a lot of the initial impacts, but certainly on the housing and on the local communities, at least for the areas that we served. And so I think a lot of those investments will help for the future if there is a ramp up. And certainly if that exists, I think a lot of the uncertainties in construction costs helps being mitigated by some of that as well, as at least there are more plans, or at least, you know, appears to be, you know, more things that at least levelize, you know, the ability to support growth in that area, which didn't exist before.
All right. No further questions from me.
Any redirect, Mr. Sanders?
Nothing further.
Sir Armstrong?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
Yes, I have a question. Considering the interaction that MDU has with WAPA and WAPA's connection with the Southwest Parapool, has the utility ever considered the possibility of switching to the Southwest Parapool from MISO?
We did, and certainly when we looked, we heard that Western and Basis were, you know, considering joining Southwest Power Pool, which was an RTO. We never had a path that would connect us with until they joined. So prior to that, the only RTO we could join was MISO, because it was the only path to it. We did look at it and did look and see, was it beneficial to that? One of the biggest drivers we ended up seeing was the difference in resource adequacy of how you meet your peak demand, and they're different between the two RTOs. So Southwest Power Pool requires everyone to be able to have enough resources to meet their non-coincident peak plus a planning reserve margin, where MISO ends up looking strictly to have resources on their coincident peak. So in other words, they take diversity of the footprint into effect when you look at how you end up meeting resource adequacy. The net impact or difference between MISO and SPP is we'd have to add an additional 120, 130 megawatts of generation capacity to meet our non-coincident peak if we would join Southwest Power Pool. And that's the biggest impediment to us in looking at an RTO change.
I see that. That makes sense. The do you believe that not being in the Southwest Power Pool inhibits your ability to plan, given that you're kind of straddling this border here?
I don't think so. And I think that was very much when we entered into our settlement with Southwest Power Pool and Western and Basin on their joining. It was one of the things where we were very conscious of how that planning would work and how we would take service to make sure that our customers were adequately protected and that our loads were planned for.
Do you believe that MDU has a sufficient ability to have an impact on the Southwest Power Pool rules? Are you able to participate as a stakeholder in their planning?
We are allowed to participate as a stakeholder in that, certainly as being a customer of, so, yes.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
We have no questions.
Mr. Fedorchik.
Darcy, I actually hadn't really thought about the different context that exists today out there with Basin being part of SPP and how that might change the a future boom and the planning of the electrical system to meet the needs of any future growth. Like, so in the future, if we see fast growth like we did before, mm-hmm. and find ourselves in a position of needing to increase the facilities to meet the needs of the electric system, how does that look differently with Basin and SPP, and do you have more transparency through this process now so you have better insights as to where you stand?
There is a lot better transparency. And just because if you have that more of a public planning process, and at least if you talk about how planning occurs, it occurs very much on a much broader level as far as the studies that they go and at least the robustness of it. You know, one of the challenges we ended up seeing, particularly under the integrated system tariff and their planning, even though we were, you know, aware with the growth that there were transmission impacts and it would at least point at how it's deficient, you know, Western would find, you know, potential ways that they could show their system was adequate, even though we knew that it was very constrained. you know, by doing things like the large amount of generation that they added was all done, and they were committing in their study cases to run that generation on peak. And so rather than to put all this load on the transmission system, they built generation and used that kind of outside of what a normal planning process would be to end up saying we will use that at least as a mitigation to at least show, you know, that their system was adequate. When in a sense as a customer, we knew there was a lot of underlying pressure on that, and the need for local generation certainly was supporting that area significantly.
Mm-hmm. So I think that ARP brought up a good point in terms of, does it make more sense now for MDU to be part of SPP? And I appreciate your pointing out the distinctions between the planning mm-hmm. and the reserve requirements. Do you see that changing with SPP moving forward, that they'll go more to the coincident peak because really their current system doesn't allow for the diversity of footprint and the economies that come with it, with recognizing that? Why would they stay on the current planning model?
So, and we've had that a number of times, at least with conversations, you know, with SPP when they've asked us membership questions, of pointing out that that's really the biggest issue, that we're still remaining solely in MISO. And certainly if they would make those changes, you know, we would be much more likely to consider that membership change. I think one of the pieces for them is when they looked at changes, and it largely driven by their stakeholders, you know, their stakeholders wanted changes that would benefit everyone, not just those people that at least may be the outliers, as we are in the case mm-hmm. of resource planning in MISO. And so one of the things that they looked in diversity was not to go to coincident peak requirements. They put a lot of effort just into reducing the overall planning reserve margin so everyone would have this benefit of a 1, 2, 3% reduction in resources they carried. They're still having conversations about coincident peak requirements, at least through their stakeholder process. But as they look at that, they keep thinking it's probably a couple years out before they would come up with something for a proposal or, you know, potential, you know, something they would implement.
So that's a bigger consideration than the fees you'd pay for having to leave MISO?
So from the standpoint of MISO, we would continue to pay obligations, you know, for transmission through their MTEP process, at least that are assigned to us. So all of the multi-value projects, mm-hmm. the other baseline reliability projects, we're still obligated to pay those in an exit. And that's the biggest part of any exit fee, is the paying for those facilities that were built to serve our loads. Mm-hmm. The thing we did with our settlement agreement that we had with Southwest Power Pool was making sure that we could find some way to minimize the net impact of having to take service from two RTOs. And so we did a lot of work in that, one, minimizing the amount of service we took and then maximizing the offsets. And that's why Ms. Cavisto was saying, at least between 2015 actuals to 2016 actuals, the net impact of all that was less than $1 million. Mm-hmm. Where when we had looked at if we would have just had to take service under Western's IS tariff, the impact would have probably been $3 to $4 million increase mm-hmm. on the expiration of that transmission service agreement. So they're joining an RTO and us taking this service and the settlement agreement saved us money than what the other more normal outcome path would have been.
So a lot of the uncertainties of basins joining SPP and the agreement that you guys have reached with SPP to serve your customers and to share infrastructure, that sort of thing, those have all been mostly settled now.
They're all settled.
Do you think the worst is behind when it comes to those kinds of transitions? Do you envision any future big risks that your customers face by you being somewhat beholden to SPP and not being an official member?
I think the question ends up being still around, and it's the comparison, and we've put in place process to do it. What's the value proposition? Mm-hmm. So annually we can look at, well, what's the net cost for us to being a customer of two RTOs versus just a single RTO membership, and continuing to make sure what we're doing is the most economical and most reliable solution that we have to meet that challenge.
Okay. Thank you, Darcy.
Commissioner Christman.
What I heard your characterization of SPP's evaluation of changing that standard so that if if you were to join, you wouldn't have to add all that transmission. Was it there was a reluctance to make the change because a lot of the other companies would get no benefit from it? Would someone from SPP argue that their more stringent standards are important to keep because MISOs are just too lax? Or what do you suppose would be SPP's response to defending the requirements that they maintain?
And we've had that conversation with Southwest Power Pool. And again, it's around the amount of, you know, generation, at least, that you have to carry to meet, you know, your shared peak demand requirements. And so one of the big things MISO has been very conscious of, you know, with its membership, is trying to provide, you know, as much synergies as it can, or find ways, you know, if there's diversity, to share in that diversity across the entire footprint. So from Southwest Power Pool's side, what they end up, and it goes back to their members, are their members are all saying everyone needs to carry still of 100% of their requirements because that's the way they've done it for the last 70 years. And they don't take a look at and say, is there some other way that the membership or the footprint diversity can provide additional benefits? And so what happens is, even if they have an overall, you know, 15%, you know, planning reserve requirement, or I think they're at 12 right now, 12% planning reserve requirement over their peak demand, once you start aggregating that across all of the customer loads, and they don't all peak at the same time, the overall footprint planning reserve margin is much higher than what the individual requirements that everyone has to carry are.
Thank you.
Commissioner Crosses.
I have no further questions.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Armstrong.
Nothing.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
No questions. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Sanderson, where do we go from here?
At this time, Montana and Dakota has no further witnesses.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong, you can step down, Mr. Nagel.
Thank you, Your Honor. good timing. I was wondering if we could take maybe a five-minute break to consult with our witness and proceed from there.
It's 11 now. We'll come back at 11:10. Okay. Back on the record, Mr. Armstrong.
Advocacy staff called Victor Shook.
Shook, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Shook, where do you work?
Work for the North Dakota Public Service Commission.
What is your position?
I'm a public utility analyst.
What do you do in that position?
I process various public utilities-related cases, rate cases, advanced determination of prudence, certificate of public convenience and necessity, damage prevention, siting.
And have you been appointed to advocacy staff in this case?
Yes, I have.
We have pre-filed testimony from Mr. Pollich, Mr. Thomas, and Ms. Cardwell. What has your position been for advocacy staff?
My position has been to be the project manager for this case. So we've reviewed, or I have reviewed, all of the testimony from our witnesses, conferred with them on our strategies and what our position has been throughout.
And has advocacy staff conducted a full investigation of MDU's rate case application?
Yes, we have.
And are you familiar with the terms of the settlement agreement entered into between AARP, MDU, and advocacy staff?
In full.
Okay. Have you been intimately involved in those discussions?
To say the least, yes.
Are you asking the commission to approve that settlement?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Sanderson, any questions?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco? Any questions for Mr. Shook?
No questions.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchik.
Okay. Hi, Victor.
Good morning.
Is it because Commissioner Kalka is gone and we've got Crosses now that we're more than halfway through and it's not even noon?
I would say that.
I think we ought to tell him that.
Absolutely.
He may be watching.
The government is more efficient now.
Yes. Can I quote you?
It's on the record, so.
Yeah.
It's directly proportional to the number of NDSU graduates.
Ooh, I like that, Judge.
Okay, so tell me why we should support this settlement. Why do you think this is a good deal for our customers?
I think this represents the best deal that we can possibly expect for our customers, while at the same time providing a just and reasonable rates for both sides, for both the company and the ratepayers.
Which components are you most excited about?
I don't know if anybody's excited about a settlement, but I guess we look at it in its totality. There's a couple of areas that helped us to be more comfortable with the settlement as a whole. I guess if you look at the settlement agreement, it kind of has the breakdown of where the company started. So it's page 3 of the settlement mm-hmm. agreement. It has the breakdown in rough dollar figures from the company's starting point to the settlement agreement dollar net revenue increase. Some of those are just kind of make sense. You know, the update for the actuals, I think that was pretty easy for everyone to agree to. The return on equity certainly was one of the points that both sides were had to give a little to come to. Obviously, the company started out requesting a 10%, and staff's witness provided 8.53.
Mm-hmm.
Decommissioning, a reduction of $1.4 million from their $1.9. That was, you know, our primary concern with that one was more so around there wasn't a lot of discussion about how the treatment of that would be in the initial application. The dollar amount was kind of secondary to that. Incentive plan, this was around employee bonus and incentive compensation. We had requested a 60% reduction. This is roughly half of that, I guess, if you want to put a percentage figure to it. And then the other capital and O&M, this was kind of where advocacy staff became more comfortable, is this kind of nondescript item.
Okay. So on the decommissioning costs, the $1.4 million reduction there, I mean, that almost seems like we're just kicking the can down the curb.
Not necessarily. So decommissioning is, in my opinion, difficult to calculate. So MDU's calculation of decommissioning expense is based on how much it thinks, how much they believe it's going to cost to decommission a plant, sometimes in 30 to 40 years. I mean, some of these newer plants are expected to run that long. Already in our review of wind decommissioning rules, we're having a difficult time estimating what it's going to cost to decommission something in 15 to 20 years. So to add 10 or 20 more years onto that, it's very difficult to say if it's, you know, how much the decommissioning would cost and if we're going to decommission it. You know, many times we'll see, you know, repowering of some of these older facilities, either switching from maybe potentially a coal to a gas or repowering a wind turbine. There's lots of different things that may happen that may make decommissioning unnecessary.
So it seems like they have a lot of older resources, actually. The newer, they've just got the Heskett 3 and the Lewis and Clark Rice that are new.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of their other units are probably closer to the decommissioning time. So you don't think that it's a real cost that customers are going to have to face in the near future and potentially not have enough saved do it?
In the near future, no. I think it is something that should be revisited in the next case to review what the appropriate amount would be, at least for those older plants that are coming closer to retirement age. I do think that it would be appropriate for it to be paid by customers as it's being used, but determining what that expense is and when that expense is going to incur.
Mm-hmm. And did you see a benefit, or I guess explain from your perspective as advocacy the benefit of doing it the way you're doing it here versus the depreciation method, where it's just an added cost to the depreciation?
So this method provides a direct offset to rate base. So whatever is collected, so year one,
so
it's going to be
depreciation, though.
It does, yes, but there's not really a good opportunity to adjust that number in the depreciation. This is basically a
because it wasn't done from the beginning. Is that what you're saying for the older facilities?
I guess either way. So it kind of comes back to what is the true amount going to be to decommission any one plant. You know, we can make estimates today, but it's difficult to say what it would be. Rather than have, you know, if we have it in depreciation, it would have to be item specific, you know. So mm-hmm. for coyote. We would say it's going to cost X million to decommission it. Well, when that day comes, it could cost a whole lot more or it could cost a whole lot less. This way, it's more of a one central fund, for lack of a better term, that can be used for decommissioning any of the plants. Mm-hmm. So if the cost is a little more or less, the collection for the other plants would help to offset that.
And so maybe doing it this way, you don't have to collect as much at a time because you can have one pot that they aren't all going to need to be decommissioned all at once.
Right.
And so then if you decommission, you can replenish the pot. Is that sort of the vision?
Yes. You could make smaller adjustments rather than more jerky things when after the expense has already happened.
Okay. We talked a little bit about the riders and the reduced ROE for the riders going back a number of years and then moving forward and how much that's going to save customers. Are you following what I'm looking for there?
I know what you're looking for. I don't know that I can assign a specific dollar amount to it just because since we came to the final agreement versus the day-to-day and how do you – it's a lot of calculations involved to figure out what the total number is.
Is it not significant?
I would imagine it would be a significant number, yes.
That seems to me something that both sides would want to know and be able to be touting. Because it's not only, I mean, you're going to, the increase is going to be X, but there's going to be another decrease, so it would be nice to know what the average net is going to be for customers.
Like the net return?
Well, no, the net increase in rates.
Well, the net increase, I think that they have in there, you know. So
yeah, but then you're going to offset with the decrease in the riders because of the reduced ROE for those.
Well, that's factored into that number. So the 3.7% net increase is including base rates and the riders.
Okay, that's different from what Nicole said. Unless I misunderstood what she was saying, that was going to be net, that was going to be on, that the reduced ROE on the riders was going to be additional savings that customers were going to see.
I don't believe so.
Okay, so that is all factored in here.
Yes.
And they're shaking heads back there.
Right. So there will be a true up that is not factored
into
this.
That's a one-time
thing. Correct. So there would be a refund to customers for both riders and interim rates.
And that, is that at the same time as the interim rate refund?
I would assume we would probably do that at the same time, but it just that would be a separate filing that MDU would make or a separate proposal.
Okay.
For here's what we propose to or how we propose and what the amounts would be of the refund for, like I said, the riders and the interim rates on the base rates.
So the reduction in the ROE for those few components that are having that, where is that factored in here on the savings? What line item is that in the chart?
So partially, part of it would be, well, no, it's not in there because you're talking about the just specifically the ROE. It's not.
So it's not a big deal. It must not be saving much money.
It is saving, I guess I couldn't say off the top of my head what the total amount is. So if you look at the ROE only portion of that, ROE only applies when there's an investment involved. If you look at the transmission rider, for example, there are a couple of investments in there today that at the end of this, as long as the settlement agreement is approved, that would move into base rates, and all that's in there is a tracker for MISO and SPP costs. There's no investment per se, so the ROE doesn't really apply going forward to the transmission rider. Okay, the generation rider today has the RICE units and the Heskett 3 in there, so there is an investment involved. After the settlement would be approved, the Heskett moves into base rates and would be subject to the ROE on the base rates, so it would not have an impact on that one. But on the RICE units, that lower ROE would apply to that going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I took this piece of the negotiations as advocacy's way of not allowing them to recover as much for the rice units.
That is certainly a way you could look at it, yes.
So I'm looking for how much that is. Is that something I'm not supposed to know?
There's not a specific dollar amount applied to that, no.
And is it factored into the table of savings or not?
I guess you could, if you look at that table,
yep,
from the 13.4, the other capital and O&M.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
That was a long road to
get there. Well, through three witnesses, but we finally got there. All right. That's all my questions for you for now. Thank you, Victor.
Commissioner Christman.
Was advocacy's objection to the decommissioning mostly based on the amount or mostly based on the fact that it was not going to go into a segregated fund?
Our initial issue with the decommissioning was it wasn't clear what the accounting treatment of it would have been. We're happy with the agreement we came to as the what the treatment of it will be. The amount was a little bit secondary to it. But we think, at least initially, for something, you know, North Dakota has had, or Montana Dakota Utilities has had power plants in North Dakota for many, many years and has not had any decommissioning funds. Part of our thought process is kind of the gradualism that we try to employ here with rate-making decisions. And we thought going from zero to 100 miles an hour shouldn't happen overnight. So a much smaller incremental increase seemed more appropriate.
In a perfect world, outside of the fact that this is a part of a big overall settlement, but should there be a completely separate and segregated fund? And if you think so, are you aware of any other regulated companies that have that?
Sure. In a perfect world where, you know, certainly there would be a separate segregated fund, there are other industries, but for example, nuclear facilities generally have a separate fund for decommissioning.
Would you have encouraged allowing a higher dollar amount if it were going into a separate fund?
Not necessarily. I guess I kind of like this treatment of it in that it can offset the rate base as this dollar amount builds. So, you know, year one there's $500,000. Year two there will be $1 million. You know, it just kind of continues building until there's an actual decommissioning event that would cause the use of that expense. But in the meantime, customers are getting an offset to the rate base. So they aren't actually getting a return on it, but it's reducing the return they have to pay to MDU in the interim.
Okay. And then advocacy's expressed a lot of concern about the planning in advance of adding the rice project. Are you convinced that everything that was done, everything that could have been done, was done now and after having more discussions? Or is this just a settlement and then we're just going to move on from that point?
I think looking at the settlement in its totality is what made us comfortable with allowing rice in as it is. It's, you know, certainly something that was a large issue for us from the get-go. I mean, even going back to the when it was initially added to the generation rider, I'm honestly not even sure how long ago that was, 6 months to a year ago. We had a lot of questions around, you know, first the need for it and second the costs associated with it. From my opinion, I think MDU and Darcy Nigam in particular did a good job of showing us how the need for it developed. The cost was kind of our primary issue going through this. And the settlement agreement partially addresses that concern.
Do you think the fact that Basin and WAPA are now in an RTO, even though it's a different one than MDU, will in fact lessen the chance of something being needed so suddenly like this without longer time for planning?
I believe so, yes. It's not going to cure every potential issue like that from happening, but I think it will help to reduce the number of times that something like that could happen.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Hey, Commissioner Crushes.
One question. Do you feel the settlement adequately addresses the concern of that the original request or the original proposal placed an undue burden on low usage customers in particular?
I think it does balancing that. You know, so the low usage customers would primarily see a larger increase with that base charge going up. I think initially the proposal was going from 35 cents a day to 65 cents a day, and this is settling at about 46 cents per day. You know, that's it doesn't it should provide that they see a lower percentage increase in their overall bill.
Okay, no further questions.
Okay, Mr. Armstrong, any redirect?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Nope. Sanderson?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle? One.
One question. Why does the settlement, or does the settlement result, it might be two questions with putting it this way, result in just and reasonable rates for MDU ratepayers?
Yes, it does.
Tell me why. Please.
That's the toughest question of the day. So I believe it provides for the company to receive an adequate, just and reasonable return on its investment. And I guess just and reasonable rates at the same time to customers. Is there something more you're...
Well, if you could just take it a step, you know, get into the details one further step. How does it or why does it result in just and reasonable rates to customers? What I was hearing in your answer was the 9.65 or whatever it is an adequate return for reasonable and adequate return for MDU. The other piece parts of this settlement, any or all of them, how do they result in just and reasonable rates for customers? That's the question the commission has to answer. I need your opinion on it.
Okay. Well, I guess, how does it do it? I mean,
I'm not trying to stump you.
Well,
I'm
you
just
are.
Looking for the answers to the notice question.
It's not really a black and white sort of a question. So, I mean, I guess just allows the company to both collect its return on its investment and a return of its investment. You know, it gives it the decommissioning expense that would help to pay for the eventual costs of decommissioning. I guess I'm not really sure what else you're looking for on that one.
That's all. Thanks.
All right. Anything else for Mr. Shook, Mr. Armstrong? In response to that, possibly?
Give me one second, please. All right. Mr. Shook, I'm going to follow up on Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle's questions a little bit. You mentioned in your direct testimony that staff conducted a full investigation, correct?
Yes, we did.
Okay. And that included several experts as well as additional testimony, correct?
Yes.
In doing that, did you, as part of the overall view when looking at that, what is just and reasonable in the grand scheme of the settlement for the company, for ratepayers, and balancing all the needs of the shareholders versus the customers, all of those good
yes.
things?
Yes.
Okay. And also checking to see if the past expenses were reasonable?
Yes.
As well as researching and determining what an appropriate ROE would be.
Yes.
Also, as well as the accounting treatment of various different expenses and such.
Yes.
And going through all of that and looking at the global settlement, I know there was, well, I'm going to take one step back. There's also various other considerations throughout the course of this case, just reviewing the operations as well as its impact on customers, correct?
Yes.
In doing that, did you come to a conclusion that the settlement reached a just and reasonable result in this case?
Yes.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Okay. Any follow-up to that, Mr. Sanderson?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No. Thank you.
Okay. Good. I think that helps clear it up a lot. Thank you. Commissioners, anything else for Mr. Shook?
I don't think so.
All right.
You could.
No questions.
Okay, you can step down. Mr. Armstrong.
Advocacy staff has no additional witnesses.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman, you have any witnesses?
No, we did not bring our expert witness here. If there was a strong desire to have her testify, we could perhaps arrange to have her testify by phone. But other than that, I would be happy to try to answer any questions the commission had.
I think it's your call whether you want to call that witness or pass on it.
I don't think it's necessary.
Okay. What about adverse counsel? Anyone think that witness needs to be called today on the phone?
No.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong. Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat.
No.
Okay. Any questions for the ARP position from the commissioners?
Can we ask?
I really, without a witness, I don't know how you could into the record.
I did have just that one question. I don't know if they could provide that answer.
You could submit.
Well, let me say this. I understand, Commissioner, that you were interested in, I guess, some maybe distribution of the percentage increases based on different usages for residential customers. I don't have that information exactly. I mean, perhaps that's something that MDU could develop. I think that, you know, we're happy with the settlement because it does not increase the fixed part of the bill as dramatically as was originally proposed. As was said, the proposal was to go from a 35-cent a day basic service charge to a 65-cent day customer charge, and the settlement provides for a 46-cent a day. Since it's not, you know, a specific monthly charge, to give you a rough idea, it's the current charge works out to about $10.50 or $10.85 per month. The increase proposed would have been $19.50 a month or over $20 a month, depending on how many days in the month. The proposal, as I calculated, 46 cents a day would be somewhere between $13.80 to $13.98 a month, what it works out. And as far first of all, I think it's important to understand that this is, rate design is, if all assumptions are correct, or a zero-sum game for the utility. Rate design just allocates the costs amongst the parties. And with this issue that was controversial and we had a lot of back and forth about is a zero-sum game within the residential class. And so the more you raise the fixed charge, the lower the per kilowatt-hour charges are, and so it has no effect on the average user. It's presumably 980 kilowatt hours a month. This change wouldn't be very noticeable. Someone on the very high end might see less than the average 5.2% rate increase as a result of this deal. Someone who uses significantly less than 980 per kilowatt hours a month would perhaps see higher than a 5.2%, and I don't know exactly what that range is. Maybe the commission could ask that the utility provide an example of someone at 500 kilowatt hours a month and someone at 1,500 kilowatt hours a month to kind of get a sense of the range. But one of the concerns that AARP came into this case with was a concern that the percentage increase, it would be a more dramatic hit for those on the lower end of the spectrum, and could also have a we have a concern about gradualism and about public acceptance. So one reason that the stipulation is just and reasonable is that it doesn't increase it as much as would have been increased. But I think it's good to keep a focus on that and understand when you see a number like $4.50 on the average increase or 5.2% on the average, that there will be customers having experiencing different numbers outside that average.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That's enough for me. Thank you.
That's more in the way of argument, really, than testimony, and that's fine. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any witnesses to call?
Oh, no, we have no witnesses. I just will have one question for the commission when it's time.
Okay. And is that something you want to do as part of?
We could do it at this point, and staff really doesn't see a need for the late-filed exhibit after this morning's testimony. So unless the commission would like the late filed exhibit, which is rerunning the cost of service study with different allocations, we would just withdraw that request. So I just bring it up.
Mr. Armstrong, what's your position on that?
Advocacy staff does not need that exhibit.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
No need.
From our perspective.
Okay. Mr. Sanderson?
The company supports staff's withdrawal of that request.
Okay. It's up to the commissioners then. Commissioners?
Yeah, no, I don't need that at this point.
I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine as well.
All right. Okay, so I guess we're at the point. I'll just one more time ask if there's any public, anybody out there who's not affiliated with one of the parties that wishes to testify. If you are here, raise your hand. Not seeing any. We can move on to closing remarks, I think, from counsel. Mr. Sanderson?
Thank you. Commissioners, on behalf of Montana Dakota, I thank you for your time and attention to this matter. As you've heard from the witnesses here today, it was a very, very long, contentious process with advocacy staff and AARP to reach an agreement in this case. There were a number of issues that you've heard, right? The rice units being, you know, one of the more contentious, the ROE, and a disagreement between the parties. And it was through many hours, many proposals, many exchanges, and quite frankly, thinking outside the box on some issues that we were able to reach a settlement in this case. The settlement agreement that's marked as Exhibit 2 outlines what the parties deem to be a fair and just settlement. And what that, from the company's perspective, from Montana Dakota, we believe this settlement will still allow us to be in a strong financial position that ensures that we can, in the future, continue to provide safe and reliable electric service to our North Dakota customers. And this settlement is something that the company believes in. At the same time, we respect the position of advocacy staff and AARP that this settlement agreement, while taking into those considerations, also provides reasonable rates to North Dakota customers. And this settlement agreement, as I indicated at the start, also contemplates that, you know, had we not reached this agreement, we would have likely been in litigation, or this hearing could have lasted 4 days. The potential that this case, through the appeals process to the district court, then to the North Dakota Supreme Court, could have lasted many years. So there was a desire for the company to take into account those risks as well in reaching this settlement agreement. And in light of all those factors, we believe that this settlement agreement is a fair and just result in the application that the company made, and we'd strongly encourage the commission to adopt the settlement agreement as reached between the parties. And we thank you for your time.
Sir Armstrong, closing remarks?
Yes, thank you. First off, I'd like to thank the staff team for the great job they did in this case and the full investigation that was done. Second, I would like to acknowledge the company and AARP for the efforts that were made in reaching a settlement. Somebody once mentioned to me that rate making is a bit like making sausage. You know, there's a lot of factors involved, and the staff team did an exceptional job of examining MDU's application and conducting discovery to reach what would be a fair and reasonable and just rates in this case. Did we have strong disagreements? Yes, very strong. We explored every avenue in this case, and we ultimately came to an agreement with MDU that we think is fair and reasonable and just and in the best interest of, in accordance with the law, you know, of what the law requires for the rate making process. And we do ask that the commission approve the settlement, and we thank you.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, I'll just repeat the fact that we are happy with the result in this case. It wasn't exactly what we wanted, but the negotiation process was very professional. MDU was very responsive and worked very hard. And so I think this settlement clearly falls within the range of results that I think are just and reasonable.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I have nothing further. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anything else we need to do for the record, the attorneys? I do want the attorneys to hang around after so we can talk a little bit about a couple of open trade secret issues and get that resolved with the court reporter, Denise. So, but anything else we need to do to complete the record this morning?
Nothing further from the company.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing from advocacy staff.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
Nothing further.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing. Thank you.
All right. Commissioners, closing remarks. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Well, this has to be a record, I think, at least since I've been on the commission. It's a little sad for Brian Crosius because he really could have learned from a full-fledged rate case hearing, but I'm not complaining, and I think that we'll have our chance down the road, I'm sure, to do the full deal. But I can imagine how in-depth and exhaustive that would have been. So I want to say the settlement and all of the testimony and rebuttal testimony really builds a strong record that the advocacy staff did dig in and look through all the company's expenses to make sure that they're reasonable, that they dug in and looked at, you know, depreciation studies and employee incentive plans and planning. I mean, it really covered a lot of important issues and so I think that, you know, that's really solid. I very much appreciate the AARP being involved as an intervener, full party to the all of the discussions and also providing testimony and bringing forth different issues than what the advocacy staff does. Interveners are very helpful, I think, in rate cases and help us make sure that we're examining all sides of an issue and getting to the best final decision. So I really appreciate their involvement and all the way through to the settlement and working to not just, you know, say, well, we'll work that out in the hearing, but trying to find an agreement. And that's really important and meaningful. And I think the settlement, you know, for ratepayers, it's a reduction in revenues of $6 million from what the customer or company originally requested. So they'll be collecting $6 million less through the settlement if it's approved than they would have been what they were requesting. So that's a significant gain for the ratepayers, and also significant changes in how that revenue is being collected, with the basic service charge being not as large a part of that for the residential customers. I think there's a place for the basic service charge, and I am not against that as a mechanism. But I think that this, what the company was asking for, was too extreme in one fell swoop. And so I think this is a much better approach. So there's a lot of components about this I really like. We'll give it very careful consideration. I'm sure we'll schedule a work session on Wednesday or Thursday, whenever our next commission meeting is, so we can work through it and come to a decision quickly, so all the parties know where we're at. So thank you very much, and look forward to wrapping this up.
Chairman Christman.
Well, I expect, too, that we'll come to a decision on the settlement option fairly quickly. I will say that when I went through the original testimony, I sure didn't expect a settlement on this one. It seemed like there was quite a divide to cross. And as quickly as it's gone, after we set aside 3 days for hearings and here are on the verge of wrapping up after a half a day, anyone who sat through this, even for these 4 hours or so, knows that a lot of careful consideration was given to this from the company, as well as the advocacy staff, as well as AARP, as well as our advisory staff, to make sure that we had, in fact, explored all the possibilities to make sure that the company is strong and yet the consumers are getting a fair and just rates. And so there were a few things where I thought that advocacy staff made tremendous points that I was feeling like I was leaning much more to their side, and some where I didn't feel that way. And there are some things in here where I think if I could start over. I would wish that they were a little bit different than what this settlement is. Some things I see as very positive, and so we'll take a little time and come up to a conclusion. But like Commissioner Fedorchak said, I expect it'll be relatively soon. Thanks, everybody.
Mr. Crosius, last words.
Well, the reality is we are trying to balance affordable rates for consumers with fairly treating industry at the same time. Industry is a major employer of individuals in the state. Consumers obviously need to have a fair rate applied to them so they can effectively manage their households, et cetera, going forward. Just some initial observations, since this is my first one, and some things, you know, just to be candid, that I want to get my arms around, would be why a number would start as high as it did and then land where it did at the end of the negotiations. And that's just something for me to get a better handle on going forward, if that's just standard to aim high and hope to come in somewhere halfway or at 60%, or if there's a better way of going about that. So that's something I'll be in tune to. And then also just more details on the decommissioning fund in particular. And I would like to have just a better handle on exactly how those funds are going to be held, or if they're in fact going to be held, and then how that can impact ratepayers, both from accruing interest on those funds going forward. So that aside, it was obvious to me that there was just a tremendous amount of work by all parties that went into this, and I was incredibly impressed. Last night when I was trying to grind through the last bits before the hearing this morning, I saw a few office lights on, and I knew people at the office here were working hard, as I'm quite sure others were as well. So with that, thank you all for being here, and for the first time around, it was quite the education.
Mr. Sanderson, will you be preparing a proposed order approving the settlement agreement?
I will, Your Honor.
Okay. One more time. Anything else from counsel for the record?
No. Okay.
All right. I'm going to close the hearing on the application of MDU for a 2016 electric rate increase. Case number PU 16-666 is closed.